coming up on Boston Public Radio. For weeks, Republicans have been reworking the health care bill behind closed doors. No town halls, no committee hearings, no legislative drafting sessions for the bill, and they're set to vote on it this next week. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us to talk about this, and we open the lines and ask you if you are ready for what has been 7 years in the making, the end of the Affordable Care Act. Then we look at Big Pharma and what happens when an antidepressant makes two people fall in love. It's the subject of the play The Effect, now at the Gloucester Stage Company. Its lead actors, Brad Hall and Lindsay Krauss, join us for that.
I'm Jared Bowen, and for Jim Browdy, we kick off Hour 2 with Andrea Cabral and a look at the state's largest prison, a huge failure to its water supply, and whether inmates are drinking contaminated water. Then CNN's John King gives us an update on Georgia's special election. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Jim Browdy is on vacation. WGBH Arts Editor Jared Bowen is in for Jim. Hello again.
Great to be with you again.
I know. I think we're really getting good at this, Jared. I really do.
Despite the fact that the Jim is in yet another disguise here in the Boston Public Library. I mean, no, dressing up as that very tall woman with the dog is fooling nobody, Jim Browdy.
No, we spotted them right away. Anyway. After weeks of laboring on a health care plan behind closed doors, Republican Senate leaders have set a timeline to vote next on legislation that would repeal huge portions of the Affordable Care Act. There have been no town halls in this, no committee hearings, no legislative drafting sessions for the bill. The Democrats are completely shut out, and so are some Republicans. Despite this secrecy, what we do know about this bill is that, as President Trump put it, it is mean, and it could kick millions off health insurance, it could slash Medicaid spending, and it could hike premiums for older Americans. Joining us line for his take on all this is Art Kaplan. He's the Doctors William F. and Virginia Conley Mitty Chair and the Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Art Kaplan, thank you so much for joining us on this today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So Art, if the Republicans come out of their secret hiding place and do pass this with the kinds of things we just talked about, slashing Medicaid, millions no health insurance, older people paying high, what happens?
Well, I think there's still a fairly good chance that this thing founders before the Senate does anything. I think this secrecy climate that they've created, look, even... Who was it? Donald Trump, if we remember him. Didn't he call this a mean bill?
He did. He did. Said it was mean.
And it is mean. It's horrible to be cruel and add to it a major dollop of secret shenanigans behind closed doors. And I don't know that it's going to get out of there. I'll tell you what I think is going to be a big factor here.
What?
You're going to maybe laugh. You know the special election today in Georgia?
Yes, I do. John Ossoff, Karen
Handel.
Yep.
If he wins, I think this bill won't pass because it will frighten Senate Republicans and other legislators who are kind of vulnerable in the next election, because that Georgia thing has turned into a little bit of a referendum on the bill. So if the Democrats score an upset in the district that Tom Price came from, I think that's the signal that this thing won't go.
Well, so Art, as we've been talking about, this is being done in secret. Mitch McConnell is holding it very close to his vest. The Democrats can't seem to get anywhere near it. They all want to be in the room where it happens. They're not even disclosing where these meetings are happening at the Capitol. What's most important to you in terms of what needs the most scrutiny and vetting here?
I'll tell you, I think there are a couple of features of the bill that we believe are in there. They certainly are in the House version that are particularly horrible. So one is Medicaid cuts. The way we used to do it, and I know everybody's eyes glaze over, but the way it was done under the Affordable Care Act, and actually before that, was to give block grants to states. The Republican bill apparently says, let's give payments per head, per capita. That means that there's going to be less flexibility, if you will, for states to move money around to figure out what whether they want to do something about the opioid epidemic or do they have other problems that are bigger because they're kind of getting a rate based on a per head basis. It just means a cut de facto on what they've got to use. They're also lopping out the rate at which payments will escalate. So they're linking it to some kind of computer price index thing that's slow in terms of getting more money in there to keep up with inflation and costs. They're not linking it to healthcare costs, in other words. They're linking it to general economic indicators. Conservatives love that because it's budget stingy, but it doesn't make any sense in terms of paying for healthcare. That's why many Republican governors have spoken up and said, if you do these cuts to Medicaid, if you cut back the amount of money we have, if you change the way we could spend it, we're screwed. We're not going to be able to cover the current crop of people.
Yeah, John Kasich from Ohio has said this over and over again. He, of course, is a Republican, ran for president, but he took the Medicaid expansion, and he's talked about how many tens of thousands of people have been covered in Ohio.
And I think the real problem isn't so much that people just get cut out of Medicaid. It means a return to the bad old days where people who are poor don't get health care to try and maintain or anticipate some kind of a problem. And then they wind up at the emergency room with a really bad problem that's very expensive to do something about, and we all wind up paying anyway. Remember, even the Republicans behind closed doors haven't really proposed just letting people die in the street. So in they come to the one place where there is a right to health care, the emergency room, most expensive place we've got with the most advanced form of their medical problem or disease. And that's what led us to try and pass the Affordable Care Act in the first place.
Well, Art, I'm wondering about the timing here, whether or not it does even go forward. But this is a time when insurance companies are looking at 2018 rates, what they're going to do, whether they're going to remain in certain states, because we've seen insurance companies pull out of parts of this country. So how does this impact what 2018 looks like for insurance coverage?
Well, strange, impossible for me to believe. They're also talking about cutting out the subsidies that were there for more middle-class people, and that means premiums go skyrocketing up. If you don't subsidize that insurance, the only other way to keep it affordable is to mandate that people have it. You'll remember that that idea was torn to shreds in the House. Certainly not going to survive anything in the Republican Congress. So either you tell everybody you have to have some minimal insurance plan to create a base that pays for the sicker, and those who already have disabilities, or you just say, look, we're not subsidizing the cost of individual insurance, and so you pay out of pocket, up go the premiums, up go the rates, down go the number of people covered because you're not mandating that they have to get this. You know, there's no free lunch. That's what the problem is here. We keep looking around and saying, you know, well, what are the Republicans going to do? The Republicans are trying to save money. They apparently want to convert money that was going to health care into some kind of a tax break. And then believe
for wealthy
that the big
people.
Yeah, for wealthy people. And then believe that that will, you know, stoke an engine of economic growth such that there'll be more income all around. Well, even if that were true, which only ideological fanatics seem to believe that it might become true, it'll take forever, years and years, to see those returns on economic growth. These fantastical rates. So that means a whole 5, 6, 7 years of no health care coverage. You know, you take it away from one end to put it into the other end, and then you wait for the magical beans to grow the beanstalk to get the rich to drive the economy forward. Meanwhile, the poor, the disabled, even the elderly who rely on Medicaid too, they're just cut out.
You know, Art Kaplan, I'm glad you mentioned the elderly relying on Medicaid, because I think we've discussed this before. There's this idea that Medicaid is about poor people, but it's also about nursing home care at the end of life. And if you are a baby boomer yourself or your parents are baby boomers, a huge number of people are in the baby boom generation are getting older and needing extensive medical care. This is going to impact dramatically, which is very scary, I think, what kind of quality of care you will be able to get in nursing homes, and even if you'll be able to get into a nursing home, since Medicaid is what pays for that.
Yeah. You know, Medicaid, when it was invented, was supposed to cover pregnant women, children, people with disabilities. It wasn't really targeting long-term care for the elderly, but over the years, more and more people realized that if they could claim disability and poverty, they could move their relatives into Medicaid. So two points about that. One, if these cuts come through, it absolutely will impact whether or not your grandfather, your grandmother can get into a nursing home at all without having a lot of money, because the program will quickly get overwhelmed in many states and won't be able to pay for nursing home benefits. And it reveals another little secret fact about healthcare discussion in America. Nobody, Democrats and Republicans, has tried to take on the issue of long-term care. So having a program for that was meant for the poor wind up subsidizing the middle and upper class as they move into nursing home needs, I don't think it's a very fair solution. I'm not arguing that we should just destroy what's there without replacing it, but, you know, think, Marjorie, how many words have been said about long-term care in the healthcare debate? I think the number will come close to zero.
Yeah, because people are trying to hide that fact, do you think?
They're so focused on acute care, heart attack, getting people into the hospital. And by the way, that's where the majority of the industry is. That's where pharma, the hospitals themselves, you know, we have a very, very good, in most parts of the country, acute care, emergency care, healthcare system. I wouldn't use those terms to describe what exists in most parts of the country about long-term care, but the lobby to get into long-term care or worry about it is far more stifled, and we don't see political pressure on legislators to fix it. I'm a little disappointed that the AARP and some of the other groups that fight for the elderly aren't louder on this problem. Because, again, the rates are huge. It's enormously expensive. I don't know if you've tried to deal with a parent who needs nursing home care, but, you know, a six-figure bill wouldn't be unusual. Why it costs what it does, I don't know. It seems to me you can stay in a fancy luxury hotel for far less than you can in a sort of assisted living place. I'm not sure what that's all about. But in any event, it's the great sort of unremarked, ignored problem of American healthcare.
Art Kaplan, while we have you on the line, we want to quickly shift gears and for a moment ask you about mosquitoes in this country now that summer's here and having spent...
And their healthcare is very, very poor.
Yeah.
Well, how should we be dealing with mosquitoes? Because obviously there's still a lot of concern in this country and, well, this continent, frankly, about the Zika virus and everything else that's transferred by mosquitoes. What have you been looking at?
Yeah, Zika started to reappear. I just saw a case for the first time in a California city. It's going to be with us. It got the nasty Zika virus, got into mosquitoes. They're in Puerto Rico. They're clearly in Florida. They're in Texas. And they're spreading out to other warm weather states. And they could get up as far as New England in the summer. So the good news is they don't fly very far. But the bad news is they can get stuck in a truck or wind up being carried on a boat or something up to here. That's really how they get here. They're not great flyers, the subspecies that carry Zika. So what do we do now to get rid of Zika? We spray. And we have an insecticide called Naylid, which has been around for a while. It's known to not be good for pregnant women or newborns. In fact, one of the public officials in Miami said, we're going to start spraying this week. And if I was pregnant or I had a newborn baby, I'd get out of town. That's
it's
how worried they are about...
It sounds so retro.
Wow.
The toxicity of this stuff. Why are we continuing to spray? It runs into our water. It poisons everything in its path. It kills not just mosquitoes, but all kinds of other bugs. We have a better technology. We can make mosquitoes, neuter them by biologically engineering them. You can put a gene into male mosquitoes, which, by the way, don't bite. Only females do, so they're not going to touch us. That renders them sterile and, that renders them unable to have offspring. They breed with the females and then the offspring don't grow. There's a couple of other tricks you can do biologically to get rid of these mosquitoes. And I think that's where we should be headed. You know, mosquitoes, not only are Zika there, we've seen West Nile, I think, just appeared today. Yeah. We got yellow fever sort of moving around South America that could get up here. And if you deploy troops to places where there's malaria and stuff like that, Americans can get exposed, and not to discount the fact that hundreds of thousands and millions of lives are lost to malaria. We got rid of malaria by spreading DDT. We just happened to kill half of nature, but okay, that's over. We did that in the 50s. That's why we don't have it. We're continuing to spray. I say, come on, we got a 21st century technology. Let's start to biologically engineer the death of these mosquitoes that don't do anybody any good. The substrain that carries these diseases is just a pest. It doesn't. There are other mosquitoes around for birds to eat and so on. And we can do it in a way that's safe and green. We're just freaked out because of GMO food fights and other things. People hear genetic engineering. They say, whoa, I don't think so. So is it better to spray poison on your pregnant spouse?
Yeah. You wrote a great piece about this, Art, talking about this. Is there some place where people can look for this?
Should be out this week in Forbes.
Okay,
so
we're looking for Forbes. Hey, but what is the Everyday Ethics podcast, Art Kaplan?
So what we're going to talk about, kind of fun, is the issue of whether you should get a pet from a shelter or should you get a pet from a shelter that promises not to kill animals.
Ooh.
No kill thing.
Oh, that's a good one.
It's a tough ethics problem because, you know, there are too many strays around and people sadly don't get them neutered, and they're also abandoning animals all over the place, cats and dogs and, I don't know, maybe miniature swine and who knows what else. But in any event, so when these animals wind up at shelters, there are those that say we don't kill them. We just put them up for adoption. But, of course, the surplus moves over to the places where they do kill them. Ethically, it's a really hard choice because a lot of people would say I don't support killing the animals, but something's going to happen to them. Either you dispatch them, or I think they're going to die out in the, you know, in the neighborhood. So really hard choice.
Well, that's a good one. That's a dilemma. I bought my cat and my dog at a pet store. It was a terrible thing to do, but I didn't know.
It was a long time ago,
I have a puppy mill baby. It's terrible. Art Kaplan, thank you very much for joining
Thanks
us. Appreciate it much.
Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's a Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly MIDI Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Coming up, we're opening up the lines and asking you, if you're ready for this, are you ready for the Republicans to complete their mission? 7 years in the making to repeal Obamacare. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We are broadcasting live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library, and Jared Bowen is in for Jim Browdy. Hello again, Jared.
Hello again, Marjorie.
Hello again. So if you are just tuning in, we were just talking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, about the healthcare legislation, which the GOP Senate leaders say will be voted on next week and how it has been worked on in total secrecy. Now we're opening up the lines to get your take on all this at 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Are you ready for this? For 7 years, the Republicans have been trying to appeal Obamacare, and next week they could actually do it. 877-301-8970. If you are for the repeal of Obamacare, are you okay with all the secrecy? If you don't like the way the GOP is going about this, is there anything that the Democrats can do to stop it? Apparently they're doing a talkathon right now. To try to slow everything down in the Senate, because, of course, they can't stop it. The Democrats do not have the the Republicans could pass this without any Republican support. All they need is two defections from their party, though, and that could make it more difficult for them to get this. But what do you think about this? 877-301-8970, and the email address is bpr@wgbh.org. I have certain obsessions, Jared, and this is one of them. I am very, very worried about this. I'm worried about, I should point out that they are saying that they are going to, supposedly, people that in the know say that they are going to still cover people with pre-existing conditions. But the question is, how much is it going to cost for those people to get that kind of coverage? And that's what's really scary.
But we don't exactly know any of this, do we,
Marjorie?
We
don't.
It's all whispered leaks.
Doesn't
this instill confidence in how major policy in this country is made, that everything is done in secret? So you have the Republicans, as you said, they're not even disclosing where meetings are taking place, keeping this very close to the vest. You have the Democrats who are doing everything they can to stall it. This is the process that's going in so that this can all be wrapped up so that everybody can go home for their 4th of July break in
right.
a couple of weeks.
And even though Mitch McConnell has said over and over again, he's a slippery operator, very smart, very good at what he does, but a little slippery if you ask me. He said over and over again, this is just what happened with Obamacare. It's not what happened with Obamacare. There were tons of meetings. The Republicans, there were tons that was debated for weeks and weeks. The Republicans had a lot of amendments to Obamacare and stuff, so it was very different. This is totally different. Mitch McConnell is talking about a 20 hours opportunity to even read the thing. But you know what I read was hopeful this morning, if you were very nervous about this health care bill, that the Senate might be allowing this to fail on purpose. At least some lawmakers have told CNN, I'm going to talk with John King later this afternoon from CNN, that holding a vote on this doomed Obamacare replacement, they called it doomed, lets moderate Republicans at least say they tried to fix Obamacare and allows more conservative Republicans to say they voted against it on the ground that it's simply another version of Obamacare. So maybe I'm getting myself worked up to a frenzy for nothing.
That's a little bit of deep conspiracy thinking, don't you think, Marjorie Egan?
I don't know, but it is very disconcerting. And the other thing that's disconcerting is that we have never really done this. We've never given an entitlement to people and then taken it away. Polls back in May had support for this bill at about 20-21%. A new Kaiser poll says that the support for this bill is like 8%. Now, I don't know enough about Kaiser healthcare polling to know if that's a good poll or not a good poll, but it does kind of beg the question, why are they doing this?
Well, it does seem consistent with other polls that have come out, maybe not as low as 8%, but you do have to wonder why they're doing this. And then, so ultimately, this looks like it'll rest on people like Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Rand Paul of Kentucky, because they could easily swing this out from the 50 votes they need, and that includes the vice president voting, too.
Yeah, and Lisa Murkowski has been very clear. She is big on funding Planned Parenthood, which is a big sticking point in this bill. As we point out over and over again, Planned Parenthood is not just about abortions. It is about health care for women, birth control, sexually transmitted disease testing, screenings for cancer things. And it allows people that don't have any money, and they may not have any health care at all if we get too far down the line here, to go in and get health care at a very affordable rate.
Well, and along those lines, groups like Planned Parenthood, patient advocacy groups, they're as removed from this as everyone else. They're saying, we want a voice here. We want to have some sort of input before this quickly gets passed.
Remember, there was some story about the American Heart Association representatives going in there with a bunch of other patient advocacy groups, and of course the biggest killer in the United States of America is heart disease, right? So they wanted to go in and meet with Mitch McConnell and talk to them about their needs, and too busy.
Yeah.
So 877-301-8970, what do you think about this Republican bill? Are you hopeful that this is not going to pass? Are you a fan of Obamacare? And Obamacare is in big trouble, as we know, but what Trump has done since he came into office has made it more trouble, because the federal government is not shored up Medicaid, and they needed to do that. Anyway, let us start with Lou from Newton. Hi, Lou.
Hi, good morning. I'm a physician, and I was not a lover of the Affordable Care Act, but if I'm not a lover of the ACA, I hate what the Republicans are maybe proposing. I'm concerned because on a number of levels. One, its impact on people who have been provided access to care in ways which they didn't have it before and are going to have that ripped away from them. Number two, I'm concerned because the basic fundamental problem that we've had with health care in terms of access and cost are not going to be addressed by this. This is clearly a transfer of monies from poor people to wealthy people, because as you've reported or talked about previously, the $800 billion cut in Medicaid is unconscionable. So anyway, the last thing I want to say is I have no hope that the Senate will do anything right. I don't know. I've made my calls. Our senators here are in line with this, but I have a child who an adult daughter who lives in Louisiana, where Senator Bill Cassidy is a quote wavering in his decision, and I have no hope that he or any of the other individuals who are wavering are going to cross that 51 vote threshold. So I'm scared and concerned for the millions of people who are going to be dumped, and these people have to. Anyway, sorry.
No, we got it. Lou, thank you very much for the call. Here's someone who's very succinct and to the point. This is from Peter. He just emailed, I'm low income and disabled. I'm screwed. Peter's, I'm not laughing at you, Peter. That is a terrible situation to be in, but I like that you got to the point of the whole situation.
When you put yourself in people's situations where nobody knows what's coming down the pipeline, we don't know. There's been a lot of talk about preserving rights for or coverage for pre-existing conditions, but we don't actually know how they're going to treat that. We don't know how at what point they look at pre-existing conditions, how much money they'll put to it. We know nothing. And again, this is a major policy that's supposed to be decided within the next 2 weeks.
Well, you know what's ridiculous about it? I mean, you just... There's a philosophical opposition to a mandate from a lot of Republicans, and I get that. I don't agree with it, but I get it. But the problem is, if you do not, it's just like car insurance. If you don't insure the young and the healthy, you can't afford to care for the sick. So they have no funding mechanism for this. This is just what's so kind of crazy about it. How are you going to pay for this if you don't? If you take these massive tax breaks, if you give massive tax breaks to the wealthy, and take away the, do you just pare it down so there's nothing left? I mean, I don't know.
Governor Baker here in Massachusetts has already talked about what it'll cost us, telling Congress it'll cost Massachusetts as much as $1 billion within just the next 3 years. So even in states such as Massachusetts, which of course had started to create universal health care under Mitt Romney long before all this happened. Yeah, it's...
Well, as has been pointed out, Obama's plan was a very put forth by, I think it was the Heritage Foundation, the conservative group. It was based on their plan, but the Republicans didn't like it. Carrie in Boston, what do you think, Carrie?
Hi, sustainer and daily listener. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thanks for calling.
I think the Republicans should be so embarrassed by this, and it appalls me that they're not even aware enough to be embarrassed. They've been yelling for 7 years. Didn't occur to them to even take a couple of hours to figure out what they might do if they had the opportunity. Unconscionable. I don't understand what they don't get about their political future, because they will own this. They will own all of this for a very long time. The pre-existing, they're kind of waving the pre-existing like, oh, it's still covered, it's still covered. People are not understanding. Yeah, it's covered, and that's their out. But it's covered at a cost that is going to be prohibitive. So it doesn't matter if you have it or not, if you can't afford it. And that's a very big deal.
Carrie,
I just don't understand, where is the input from the others? How can they do this behind closed doors? It's beyond comprehension. This is the most important thing they've got in front of them, and they're so greedy. And all they're looking at is their own pockets and a tax break down the road.
Carrie, thank you very much for the call. We're going to squeeze in one more call here before we move off. Carol in Winchester, thank you for calling.
Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I'll be succinct. I cannot believe they are trying to shove this down our throats. Doing it in a secret, it just doesn't seem like it's a democratic process. And frankly, it just seems like they are ignoring all of the data just to have a win. And, you know, it's just nauseating. And I worry about my children. You know, I have two children that are 18 and 21, and what's going to be, you know, their future for healthcare?
Well, they have to hope they don't get sick, number one. And number two, they have to hope that whatever sickness they get is not going to be too expensive, because it would go back to pre-Obamacare days when there was a limit on how much your insurance companies would cover you for, and if you reached it, you were out of luck. And I'm getting email, including from my buddy Art from West Bridgewater, quoting Nancy Pelosi, saying we have to pass the bill to find out what's in it. Yeah, she did say that, but you can't deny that there were weeks and weeks of hearings, and there were budget sessions, and there were Republican amendments, and the bill was, I don't know what it was, 2,000 pages long, and so people didn't have a chance to read through it. But that is different than meeting, and it's all men, by the way, 13 men, because women don't have any health problems, as we know. They shouldn't be considered in these kinds of discussions. You know, they're meeting in secret, and they're going to shove this out with 20 hours. So it's not, despite the spin from the GOP, it's not the same as what went on with Obamacare. It's different.
It is different. Well, coming up, what happens when Big Pharma, speaking of healthcare, plays matchmaker? The chemistry, literally, between a couple in a pharmaceutical clinical trial is the subject of the new play, The Effect, now playing at Gloucester Stage Company. That conversation with actors Lindsay Krause and Brad Hall next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
To Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady is out, Jared Bowen is in, and we are broadcasting since it's Tuesday from our WGBH studio live at the Boston Public Library. So we all know the PSA about what your brain looks like on drugs. But what does your heart look like on drugs? Specifically, an antidepressant. That question is central to the play The Effect, where two doctors running a clinical trial stumble upon what could be Viagra for the heart. In studying their two subjects who fall in love during the trial, the biochemistry of their chemistry raises a lot of questions. Is there such a thing as objectivity? Can we trust our feelings and what makes us who we are? The Effect is having its New England premiere at the Gloucester Stage Company through July 8th. The cast is led by Academy Award nominee Lindsay Krause, the writer and director and Saturday Night Live alum Brad Hall. Brad Hall and Lindsay Krause, thank you very much to have you here. We spent a lot of time, I think a lot of us, worrying about what our feelings are really about. But tell us, let's start with you, Lindsay. Tell us about the basic plot lines of The Effect.
Oh, Lord. all right, well, it's two couples in this play, the, quote, older ones. I'm talking about myself.
And Brad's raising his hand.
I know.
The older ones are the two doctors that are running the trial, and the younger ones are the victims, so to speak, of what we are perpetrating. But the two older doctors, we have had a relationship in the past, and we come together at this midpoint in our lives with two very different ideas, you know, two psychiatrists talking about how to deal with what happens when you're not happy, how to deal with what happens when you have a failed relationship, when the things that are most important to you don't work out. So one takes the point of view that we need to keep developing new generations of drugs and that this is the answer, you know, to his life and to other people's lives, and I'm adamantly against this. So
I saw this, and I haven't been able to get up to Gloucester. I'm coming soon, but I did see it in New York last year, and it gives you, this is one of those plays that you walk out with so much to think about. It kind of dismantles your life a little bit. It dismantles your relationships a little bit when you think about how much can be contrived and how much...
Is that a good thing?
I don't know, but it's a good thing.
I don't know.
I remember seeing it down in the Village and walked all the way back up to Midtown having a conversation with my friend about this, a 40-minute conversation. But how do you look at this in terms of... what it says about relationships, and especially in 2017, where we know there's constant development in this regard to manipulate us certain ways.
We've talked about this a lot, because how much is it about personal relationships, and how much is it about what a relationship is doing chemically to you and emotionally to you? And so we've tried in doing the play. I love Lindsay's description of it. I had no idea that was what it was about. Good Lord.
Oh, yeah? What do you think it was about,
that's
Brad?
That's just my answer today, Brad.
No, but we've tried to connect it to the characters that we're playing and their relationship. And it turns out that in the play, without giving anything away, a lot of it has to do with how people take care of each other. People that care about each other, how do they take care of each other? And if one is not being taken care of by someone, is there a chemical way to be taken care of? If someone is unhappy, can they be made happy? And that's a pretty profound question, and I bet that's what you were talking about. Yes. As you walked uptown. But I think that the play, like any play, if it's going to be successful, has to be about actual people. So that's what we've been trying to figure out is who yeah. the heck are these people.
And these two young people come together and they fall in love. But, you know, when you read these stories that like a fifth of America is on some sort of antidepressant,
right.
you just wonder, gee, you know, suppose you get off the antidepressant. Does your marriage fall apart? Or
right.
do you
exactly.
not like your children as much as you used to like your children? I mean, what's your, you know, who's the real you
yeah.
know, kind of thing?
That's
which
very
is,
much
which
what
is,
it's about.
So have you learned anything brilliant and insightful that you can share with us today about what the real you is, Lindsay Krause?
Well, I think what is profound in the play and why it makes you maybe walk uptown and keep talking about it is these questions are very much on our minds right now. We're a culture and a society that has moved towards looking for happiness in external things. And the drug could be considered an external thing. You know, we're stimulants and entertainment and whatever we're burying ourselves in. And who are you if you're not the successful one? If your life is not working out the way it looks as though it should on television, if, you know, the way this jangled and jacked up culture is, you know, racing to the finish line and you're not coming in first, second, or third, what kind of examination do you make up of your life, and do you need something to change that?
When you were talking, I was thinking about, I know that you have been practicing Buddhism for quite some
time.
And that whole sort of a lot, the external or the internal. So would I be happy if I became a Buddhist?
Yeah, you'd be happier. You'd be happier. Because it gives you some really great things to think about, and they help.
We'll give you a crash course here.
We'll give you a crash course.
Step aside for a few minutes.
But the internal-external thing is a big thing, and I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
That we are always looking for the external, and then it's endlessly disappointing.
That's right.
There's a line, actually, in the play where one of the doctors is talking about how people are very comfortable with heart transplants and liver transplants and things, but that we can't imagine a brain transplant because that's us. So we think of our brain as being us. So if that's the case, and I suppose it is in a way, I don't know if that's how you would quantify that medically, but if the drugs that we're developing now, or if there are medications that go right to your brain, what is that? Are we changing ourselves? Is that if you're taking an antidepressant, are you becoming a different person? And these are difficult things to grapple with, and so that's what she's tried to do.
So I have the process question for you, because it's a small play with these two couples, and your couple has this great history that you're trying to figure out, and then you have this new couple that falls deeply in love. I'm trying not to give too much away, and then they have to figure out whether they really are falling in love. But it depends so much on the chemistry that the actors have, or this doesn't work. So how did you two know that you could do this?
We don't know that yet.
We're hoping for the best.
We're hoping.
All those refunded tickets are going in right now.
Yeah. Actually, that brings up a really interesting thing that happens to actors as they're in the process of creating something, which is I'm playing a person who suffered from depression and mental illness and has a lot of insecurities, which she tries to cover. And those things have plagued me throughout the rehearsal process. Really, how to play this, how to communicate this, am I doing it, is it coming across, how much do I hide? And then the confusion, is it the actor that's having a problem, is it my portrayal that's, really, right up until, you know, Sunday's performance, when we had enough information, had been working on it a while, that we just made some choices, and that's what we're doing. So, yeah, I think the play also presents some of those disturbing questions. We all walk about all day going, is this what I meant? Is this all right? Is this as good as it can get? You know.
So if people don't know, I'll just give a little background here. Lindsay Krause and Brad Halder are with us today. Lindsay was in Places of the Heart, All the President's Men, The Verdict, a lot of TV stuff, Hill Street Blues. You've been behind a lot of great directing and producing and putting forward a lot of great TV shows. Single Guy, Frasier, Brooklyn Bridge.
We're talking about Brad now. We've
talking about Brad. Yeah, I'm sorry. We switched to Brad. So, you know, that's very different than doing a little intimate theater up in Gloucester. So, why are you doing this, Brad?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'm revisiting the whole idea. No,
Saturday Night Live. I did not mention Saturday Night Live. You were one of the originals on Saturday Night Live as well.
That was a while ago.
No,
I mean, I grew up doing plays, and I have always thought of plays as the most fun thing. And then when one doesn't do plays for a while, you sort of think, well, what would be a good way to get back to doing that? That's honest and actually about the work, and not just about running out and doing some, you know, marquee thing with somebody or other. So this turned out to be the perfect way to do it. Sam Weissman, who directed the play at Gloucester Stage, is a guy that I've worked with hundreds of TV episodes and a bunch of movies, and we've worked together a lot. In fact, we worked with Lindsay 25 years ago or something, or 20 years ago on a movie.
Yeah.
Bye Bye Love.
Oh, yeah. Bye Bye Love. Yeah.
Bye, yeah. So it was a very good way to get back into doing this, where the work was what was important. That's the thing I love about small theater, and Gloucester Stage is so lucky to have somebody like Lindsay, who's a serious actress who could be doing anything that she wants to do, and here she is doing this because the work turns out to be rewarding in its own regard, which is what's delightful about theaters that are just about doing the theater.
It is a nice scam that you have. You have all the theaters in the country. You go to the seaside theater at Gloucester.
Well, you've just uncovered the truth.
Lobster rolls in close proximity,
yes.
Which I might make always a condition of my going up to that theater.
You can actually sail your boat directly to the backstage area.
Yeah.
That's not, you can't do that in a lot of theaters.
Which is very, very nice. You know, I just mentioned the Buddhism with Lindsay. I mean, you're unusual in another way. People may know you've been married for a long time. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and you guys met at Northwestern. And you've both had extraordinarily successful careers. That is so unusual in Hollywood. You always hear about one.
Well, life too, probably at this
point.
Well,
in life, that is true. That is true, because I think you've been married since the late 80s.
We have. We've been married 30 years on Sunday.
Oh, congratulations. Congratulations.
Crazy. She was 13 and I was 14.
Exactly. So is this just because your wife has a good sense of humor? Or
I think it is. Well, she's very busy. I don't see her that much.
Yeah.
So that's key. That really, really helps. No.
She said she fell madly in love with you when you had Jesus-like hair and a very long beard.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yes.
When
19 years old. Exactly.
Yeah. I had a lot more hair, I'll tell you that much.
Well.
But, we've been together a long time. And we lucked out. We met the right people at the right moment, being each other. And I really think a lot of that is just luck and hard work. And we had really, really, really nice kids fairly early and had a lot of fun playing with them. So I don't know what the secret to that is. But I will say that we did a lot of plays together starting out, and we did a lot of theater, and we cared about the performances first, and all the fame and fortune stuff that Julia's been lucky enough to luck into, I think, is entirely a side note that's just been, she appreciates how that's luck, and we know an awful lot of really, really good actors who have worked really, really hard and have not had that kind of luck, so we keep our eye on the prize of the work.
And Lindsay, we've spoken in the past when you've been on Open Studio, but you've made an effort to come back to theater because for it sounds like for similar reasons to Brad, that this is what you find, having done it all, essentially, that it's what nurtures you most. Is that what you've found in it?
Absolutely, because you get to build something. You get to actually build something. When you, the actual work of making a movie or working in television is in very tiny bits. So it may add up to something, you hope, but in the theater, you're really in charge of that. You're running the race yourself. And I find it deeply rewarding. And I love a small theater because you're really in communion with the audience. You really feel your audience.
How does that change if you're doing a television show, for instance? Your character is continuing to evolve, so you can look to the long road, the long race. But you go into that every night when you're in the theater of knowing that full arc of your character for that play. How do you adjust and reset every night?
Well, people say to me, it must be so wonderful to be somebody else. You know, I say, well, I wish that they would show up at the dressing room at 8 o'clock. Or don't you get sick of doing the same thing over and over again? And again, why would you be nervous if you could do the same thing over and over again? Brad, I can tell you, it is never the same. Because it's alive. It's alive and it's in your hands that night. And especially if the play is a great work and it has a certain kind of depth, you're learning something. because there's a tremendous, a deep unconscious coming out of a play that you're discovering every night more and more, and able to also prove to yourself that you can be open and brave. And that's a really, I mean, I think it's why men go to war. I think that's one of the most rewarding situations that anyone can put themselves in.
Okay. I think that's so well put. And when you're doing a play, it's never done. That's what's so... On Sunday, we did the show, and then the Veep that was on that night, I happened to have directed. That thing was done ages ago, and I didn't even watch it because I've seen it a billion times, and by the end of when it came on the air, it's the same as it was the last 19 times that I saw it. But a play will be entirely different every single time, which is a remarkable thing, actually. It's a growing, living organism.
You know, I wonder, when you do a show like Veep or any of the other TV shows you've done, to get that half-hour episode, how much time are you putting in terms of just the takes and the retakes and the acting?
Lindsay can tell you, it's infinite. It's as infinite. Long as you have it, and the work expands to fill the time allotted. So if you're lucky enough to have 5 or 6 days to shoot, you will shoot 15 or 16 hours a day, and then the work of editing begins, and that's not to mention the year that went into writing the script before you shot it. So it's a constant, never-ending beast that eats your entire life.
I read in something in preparation for your coming today, I think it was something about your environmental concerns, about Hollywood. It's a morning town, that everything starts like really early in the morning. People have to get the set early in the morning.
Yeah.
So is that... Why is that? What are you talking about? You're talking about 7 o'clock in the morning, people work till midnight?
My theory is everybody's from New York, and when they moved to the West Coast, they forgot to set their clock. No, you start at 5 in the morning on a movie set.
Really?
Or earlier.
Oh, absolutely.
Women have to get there at 4 o'clock in the morning to start making up. And then you work all night. So, and then there's a couple of hours to go home and regret what you did all day long. but I'm cheerful about it.
I think it would be a problem in the bags under your eyes if you didn't get any sleep. But go ahead, Jack, before I get to my Paul Newman obsession.
Okay. Well, you just mentioned directing Veep, and I'm wondering what it's like to direct with your wife, or if it's collaborative. Because as soon as you said that, I remember reading this great profile of your wife from a couple of years ago where she really described comedy and very analytically, very scientifically, physical comedy, and how this change of the wrist is funny, but I'm making this up. But essentially, how she broke it down, and I thought it's just there's so much to it. It's so smart. It's so clever. You have to pay attention to every single nuance, gesture, intonation of voice. So, that, I guess that's two questions. How do you do comedy, which I won't ask you, but how you work together on that show?
We've worked together a lot. So I mean, we met working together. So it's actually weirder to not work together. For us, so there's that. That's nothing new. But I mean, I think that the thing about comedy, again, that's one of the main differences, big differences with the theater and doing television stuff. Like Lindsay said, it's just a little tiny bit. So if you've got a bit where you've got it wrong, and then you can stop in the middle of the take and say, whoa, let's do that again. No, let's try it again, and then 1,000 takes later, maybe you've got it just right, or you think you've got it just right, and then you get to the editing room and realize maybe you didn't, and you have to cut around it. But in the theater, it's so much more organic. You're telling the whole story. You're actually with the other actor. Oftentimes in television or movies, the other actor is done and they're gone, and you're shooting with a stand-in maybe that you're talking to. So the life of the play is a richer. I don't mean to compare them, good versus bad, but it's a very different experience because the whole in the theater is what's important. You're telling a whole story. And with a play like this, that's kind of episodic and it doesn't follow an exact narrative, it complicates the approach. Mm-hmm. And that's why we wish we'd had a couple of more weeks of rehearsals. So now that we're actually running the play, we'll start to discover what it's about. And we really will learn much more about it as we go.
We're talking to Brad Hall and Lindsay Krause. I've restrained myself, but now that we're almost at the end of this interview, The Verdict was a great movie, set a lot in Boston. I love that movie. When I was a kid, you starred in that movie. You were the Irish nurse with a wonderful Irish accent that really, if people don't don't remember, it blew open this case where a hospital had done this terrible thing, and Paul Newman was the star. So, for all of us, I can't be the only one, who went out and bought the Paul Newman stamps as soon as they became available.
I never knew this.
Oh, yeah. I'm curious what he was like to work with.
Paul was a great man. He was a great man. I was very lucky. I worked with him on two movies, on Slapshot.
Yes.
With George Roy Hill. They were great friends. And then with Sidney Lumet. And Paul was the most generous actor.
Oh, good.
The most generous actor. And very, very hardworking. So he, if you wanted to take him aside for a minute and try something or talk to him about something. And I'll tell you one story, which was very sweet. Slapshot was one of the first movies that I ever did. And we had a scene that was emotional. And we filmed it at night up to a certain point, and then at the point where I had to cry, we had to break and then get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and shoot it with the sun coming up for some reason, I can't remember. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, the scene isn't there, you're not emotional, and I thought, I'm going to let everybody down. If I can't cry, I'm going to let everybody down. How do I do this? And Paul leaned over to me before we started, and he said, look, he said, it's freezing cold, you haven't had any breakfast. You may feel a little nervous about getting where we were last night. He said, they have something called a menthol blower. They just blow through it gently on your eyes. It starts your eyes watering.
Oh.
He said, nobody's going to know except you and me. You know, who cares? It's going to start you feeling that you're there, and then you'll have more faith. They took the little menthol blower. They blew it in my eyes. My eyes started to water. The sun was coming up. Action. And we did the scene. And I've never been so grateful. You know, and he sat and he talked to me afterwards. He said, sometimes, you know, it's God-given and it comes through you. Sometimes it's a technical thing you do. He said, you're still an actor, babe.
Oh, that's a great story. That's a great story. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being here. It's been wonderful to talk to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lindsay Krause, I'm going to buy the Lindsay Krause stamps when they're released. I just want you to know. Brad Hall and Lindsay Krause star in the New England premiere of The Effect. It's at the Gloucester Stage Company through July 8th. To learn more, go to gloucesterstage.com. Coming up is the Flint, Michigan water crisis happening right here at the Norfolk Prison. Former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrea Cabral joins us for that and more. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. 6 years ago at the state's largest prison, toilets wouldn't flush, the water was brown, and showers didn't work. It turned out there was excessive sediment in the pipes. That was in 2011. The state has still not built a new system, and inmates are worried their drinking water is not safe. Former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety Andrew Cabral joins us for that and other law and order headlines.
I'm Jared Bowen in for Jim Browdy. In 2017, has pride been appropriated by heterosexuals? Is this progress or cultural appropriation? Sue O'Connell of Bay Windows joins us for that. From there, we look at a different kind of appropriation, Amazon buying Whole Foods. Will the online retail behemoth cut jobs, cut costs, and cut corners when it comes to quality food? We'll ask historian Nancy Kane from Harvard University. Then it's back to the Beltway for someone quick to tweet about everything. Why has the president been mum on the latest terrorist attack in London? Next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to hour number two of Boston Public Radio. Since it is Tuesday, we are broadcasting live from our beautiful WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Jim Browdy is on vacation, but executive arts editor at WGBH, Jared Bowen, is here. Hello, Jared.
Thrilled to be here at the library with all of our fun people here.
I know. Isn't it wonderful? And also here is the star of the Sunday version of BPR, Andrew Cabral. Thank you very much for being here, Andrew Cabral.
Thank you.
And she, of course, is here for us for another edition of Law and Order. Andy Cabral, you may know, is the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. Thank you very much, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. We're having a ball.
Yeah, good. So You know, I want to. You were, in addition to being at the sheriff and in public safety, you were also for many years a prosecutor in Suffolk County. Did a lot of domestic violence work. I'm sure you came across some sex assault cases, some rape cases when you were there.
A lot, yeah.
I wonder what your take is on the hung jury in the Bill Cosby case. I was surprised.
I was surprised too. You know, there are always sort of difficult cases to prove. I disagreed with the judge who decided that no other witnesses could come forward to prove pattern, because both in domestic violence cases and sexual assault cases, proving a pattern of behavior, especially when that pattern is as distinctive as I sort of get to know you, invite you back to my hotel or my home, and there's a pattern of getting you into a relaxed situation, giving you drugs, and assaulting you when you're unconscious or not conscious enough to defend yourself, that's a pattern. And that is ordinarily admissible.
Well, how much, I don't know if you had to deal with this at all, the celebrity factor or even notoriety in a case, but obviously you can't ignore who Bill Cosby is here, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a jury. Of course, you're going to say they're objective. That's their job as a juror, but you're hard-pressed to find somebody who doesn't know Bill Cosby and doesn't know his legacy. So do you think that's as much to blame here as anything for the mistrial?
Well, I think it probably had something to do with it. It may have had a lot to do with it, and that's why I'm sort of so fixated on the judge denying the prosecution the opportunity to, there's some 60 women that have come forward. So if you're going to put in evidence of pattern, the judge's job is to make sure that the probative value of what they're going to testify to is greater than the prejudice that might inure to the defendant by having a series of people get up and say over and over again, people who are not the actual victim in the case, this is what happened to me. And one would think that just weighing how to overcome his celebrity and the benefit that inures to him as a celebrity, that a judge would have balanced that by allowing at least two of the other women, whose pattern most closely fit that of Andrea Constan, to testify that's exactly what happened to me, because it makes what she says more credible, that the same person, and they don't know each other, none of these victims know each other, it happened to people who were strangers to each other, and the only thing they had in common was Bill Cosby. That's what surprised me about the judge's ruling. I think the judge was wrong.
And the judge thought this would be too prejudicial.
I don't know what the... I'm sure the argument was made. I don't know what the judge said on the record in terms of why he was denying it, or if he just denied it without further explanation. But I don't see why that would not have been appropriate.
Just one last question for me anyway about this. It just seems to me, particularly in sex assault cases, we have a real hard time believing victims. If they have like one little nick in the story, oh, well, she lied about this, she must be lying about that. And you see this a lot when people tell you something that's disturbing, whether it's the kids in the Catholic Church case or even in politics with the former FBI Director Comey testifying about what Donald Trump did. You hear people telling these stories, and we want a perfect victim.
Right.
What is that about?
And so what we forget, and this happens frequently in domestic violence cases, even without a sexual assault component, is we are expecting a victim to behave completely rationally in an irrational situation.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So we're expecting a person who has been traumatized by an assault to behave the way someone who's not been sexually assaulted would behave. Oh, well, if that were me, I would have called the police immediately. Or if that were me, I never would have spoken to him again. Or if that, forgetting how many times we ourselves have been in compromising positions where when we look back on it, we think, why didn't I say something? Why didn't I do something? But you see people on a jury, and they somehow begin to hold victims to a standard that they themselves in the same circumstances could not meet.
I've never thought of that. That's such an excellent point.
It's true. It just happens.
Well, speaking of other trials that may have surprised people last week, of course, Philando Castile, there was a trial for his shooting. The police officer was found not guilty. But one of the things we wanted to ask you about is there's a question about the NRA's silence around this case, because ordinarily, if there might be a case like this where somebody is armed, he gets shot by the police, they turn around and there's a huge public outcry because of your right to bear arms, but we've heard nothing from the NRA in this case.
Yeah, and he had a legal, valid permit to have that gun. He had followed all the rules to have a gun. There was a great quote from the Congressional Black Caucus who told the Associated Press, the guy that is the head of it, said that essentially what this verdict says is that African-Americans, the Second Amendment does not apply to African-Americans.
Well, it's true. I mean, let's keep in mind a couple of things. He wasn't driving. He was in the passenger seat. The car was stopped for two reasons, according to the officer. One that had supposedly had one brake light was out. But the officer also said, and I think he might be the suspect in one of our robbery suspects, because of his wide-set nose. Now, imagine if someone stopped someone who was Asian because of the tilt of their eyes, which is an immutable characteristic to Asians, just like a wide-set nose is generally an immutable characteristic to black people. That wouldn't be acceptable, right, if you simply said... But that's why he said he stopped him. According to everything that I've seen, and certainly reiterated by his girlfriend who was doing the live stream on Facebook, she said, "We told you he had a gun and that he had a valid license for it. You told him to take out his license." Now, I assume that was the driver's license, but he asked the driver's still seated in the car. She hasn't been asked to get out of the car, and she's got a laptop or an iPad. He's in the passenger seat with a seatbelt on, and he's reaching for his own driver's license to prove who he is, and he shot 7 times in front of his 4-year-old daughter. Keep in mind, this is a cop shooting into the car with 2 other people in it, one of whom is a child. I don't understand this verdict at all, and I also don't understand why, again, the judge in this case seems to me put his thumb on the scale by not allowing the prosecution to confront Yanez, who was the officer, when he got on the stand, with the video of his interview with the their version of what state is this in?
Minnesota.
Minnesota Bureau of Investigation.
Thank
right.
You, Jared.
So he was interviewed 48 hours because their contract allows them time to recover from the shooting. If you're a police officer, he was interviewed 48 hours later. And it's there. They have at least have audio, if not audio and video. And the prosecution chose not to put it in their case in chief. They chose to wait to see. And it's a risk that everybody would take. You could not put it in, and then maybe he wouldn't take the stand. But if he does take the stand, that's legitimate cross-examination. And the judge just decided that he didn't like the fact that they were trying to get it in for impeachment purposes, and he didn't allow them to put it in. It's a prior statement by a defendant made close in time to the actual incident, where he's got a lawyer present and he's being questioned by police officers. There's so much about this case. You keep using words like troubling and disturbing and infuriating and outrageous, and so all those words have lost their meaning. But this is truly horrific what happened to this man. It defies all description that they found him not guilty, and I don't know if or when they'll interview these jurors, but it's outrageous.
Well, at least the police department decided not to take him back, saying, we don't believe this would be in the best public interest to have him on the force anymore.
But there were some weird extenuating circumstances that I'm not aware of. Was the judge in this case maybe too close to the police department? Was this case moved out of the jurisdiction? Because it does seem, and what was the makeup of the jury? Do we know any of those things at this point?
I don't know. I know that the jury, there were, I think, at least 2 people of color on the jury. But I don't know anything really about the judge's background.
Yeah.
But these are, and whether or not, what his relationship might be with the police, but this is basically how trials go. You know, like I said, you have a video of the defendant. As a prosecution, ordinarily, would you put it in during your case in chief? Yes, you ordinarily would. If you choose not to, and you take the risk that the defendant may not testify, then you're out of luck because you have no basis to show the jury that video. But he did take the stand, and they wanted to put it in to impeach him. And I just do not understand why the judge wouldn't allow that to happen. And also, even without it, I don't understand how he could have said that he genuinely feared for his life from a seat-belted passenger who told him he had the gun. It would be different if the guy had a gun and didn't have a permit to carry it and didn't tell him any of that, and somehow he saw an outline of a gun in the guy's pocket. That didn't happen.
So why do you think the NRA has been silent?
Because the NRA has long built its power base on the fear of black people generally. It's not overt, but that's the reason that they tend to encourage people to buy guns. They're not necessarily talking to an audience of people of color. They don't push it aside. They don't reject having people of color as NRA members. But this isn't the first time that they have remained conspicuously silent when the person was legally carrying a gun and has been killed by the police. And they also don't want to alienate the police, which is among their largest base of NRA members.
You know, it's interesting. This story interviewed a guy that is from the National African American Gun Association.
Right.
So perhaps that's why there's a National African American Gun Association, because
they
do not want to be in the NRA or don't feel welcome in the NRA. Well, anyway, let's get back closer to home. David Abel did this incredible story a couple of days ago in the Boston Globe about, you know, to just put this in context, we've all talked about the disgrace out in Flint, Michigan, where people, the water is undrinkable, and people are actually facing criminal charges and may go to jail, state officials there, which makes me very happy. We'll see what happens to those cases. We've had stories about the lead content in the Boston public schools being too high in some of our public schools here, so kids can't drink the water there from the water fountains. Now this story, and I was embarrassed, I was not aware of this. Apparently we've known this for quite some time because the samples were taken back in 2011, that there is very bad water in the prison down in the...
In Norfolk.
Yeah. And people, inmates there, many of whom are there for life, risk getting sick, symptoms possibly developing that resemble Parkinson's disease.
Right. Apparently the it's sediment in the pipes, and they talk about the chemical that they mention most prominently is manganese.
Yep. Never heard of it.
I think I heard of it in high school, and yeah. I remember Bill Murray said something about it in Caddyshack. You know, honestly, I'm one of those people who could probably quote the movie, right? But I don't know what the, certainly don't know what the effects of ingesting too much of it are. And oddly, I mean, as soon as I saw the story, I rushed to read it because it shocked me that in the 2 years I was secretary, that maybe the one thing I never heard that I had to, it was a problem that I needed to address, was the water quality. But it doesn't surprise me because the prisons are old and the systems are old. And you can say, just as we've said a million times about things like Bridgewater and other things, this is what you need to do to correct it. And everybody knows that those things cost money. Changing either the water filtration system or replacing pipes or whatever it is that you have to do in an institution as large as MCI Norfolk, and it's probably in other places as well, is very, very costly. So, you know, at the beginning of the fiscal year, people are probably talking about this is what we need to do to replace this. And by the end of the fiscal year, when they're looking at budgets, no one's going to appropriate the money to do it. And it really does need to be done. You can't just have a prison exist for decades and decades and not address stuff like
well,
this.
Well, speaking of addressing it, to me, one of the most disturbing elements of this story, and I feel like I encountered this at some points when I was back in my days when I was just covering straight news, is resistance you get from the Department of Corrections when you want to see something inside prison or you want to talk to a prisoner. They wouldn't allow, they tried to obstruct access for the Globe reporter here. Finally, the reporter was allowed in with just... Actually, with nothing, because you're not allowed to bring in a pencil.
No notebook, no pen.
Right, exactly. Right. So you wonder how situations like this can even be addressed when the system is clamping it down so that they can't get these arguments out. And you have one prisoner who's saying that he's washing or drying off after taking a shower, and his towel looks like he's just scraped it across the floor. It's so dirty.
Yeah, right. And so what tends to happen... And I'm not talking about this case in particular, obviously, but what tends to happen is the fight between how much litigation is going to result as a result of this and the right of an inmate to talk about what their conditions are to a reporter. Now, I hate that you constantly find yourself in this position when you're in government, because really what I think most people want to do is fix it and fix it right then. and then you don't fix it for whatever reason, whether there's no money or there's no inclination or no will to do it. I don't know what you know, it could be any combination of things. And it gets worse, and you become more resistant to letting people know how, perhaps how bad it's gotten. And as I said, I'm not speaking about this particular case, but I think that because government, the money to do the things that government should be doing is either feast or famine, and so everybody's budget lives by the grace of the slaughter. You don't address things that you should address and should address in a timely manner. And the longer you don't do that, the worse it gets. And then you find yourself having to explain a lot more about why things haven't been fixed. I mean, well, a special appropriation to do this. I mean, you're going to have to move people.
They're not going
to
do it because it's a prison. I would be stunned. If they haven't fixed the water in the Boston public schools,
right.
They're not. I would be stunned if you had someone going to, which is unfair, but prisoners' rights are at the bottom of the list unfairly in a lot of politicians' minds.
I used to say all the time, though, if you let's take a look at what we've paid out in settlements and judgments.
That's a great
because if you look
that's
at
a
that,
great
that's
point.
The real cost to you, not
yep.
and
that's
the
a great
cost
point.
To the person who had to bring whatever the damages were that they incurred, either to their health or whatever it might be. That's the real cost of it. But it's really hard to make that argument when, you know, there's a $1 billion budget deficit, and they're saying to all of the agencies, you've got to cut your budget by 10%, you know, in the next 2 weeks.
Can't they at least bring bottled water into MCI Norfolk in the interim so that you don't have to be in prison for the rest of your life thinking you can't drink the water?
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple of things that they could do. They could, clearly they sell bottled water in their canteen, and it costs you 65 cents to buy a bottle.
Which we should point out, it was addressed in the article, too. It sounds like not a lot, but that is a lot of money to a prisoner.
Right. If you're getting working in the prison and you're getting, like, sort of a daily stipend or whatever it is, it's half of that.
I mean, so, free bottled water.
Right.
I mean,
exactly. No,
should we bring in free bottled water?
No, that's true. And so what will happen then is... You will have on your balance sheet, you know, that the state is paying for free bottled water for inmates, which then begs the question, why do you need to do that, and how much is that costing? And that's why I said, you know, it's unrealistic of me to sit here, because I was in government for so long, to think that things are all going to get addressed in a timely manner. But there are some things that just last too long. And, you know, I always think of Bridgewater. And every administration will inherit that kind of a thing because, again, I've been gone since 2015 and still nothing's really changed with that because it's going to cost a lot of money.
Well, we had the story about the Arbor healthcare, and that's a privately for-profit run mental health facility. And the story as presented in the Globe was absolutely horrific, the way even children are being treated there, and they've cited them over and over again, and nothing seems to change. I mean, it's like the public sector and the private sector. It's and I think it'll all be helped when we have a healthcare bill that cuts even more money.
Right. Well, that's the other thing. I think we have been very much moving toward a place where we really make no investment in the most vulnerable of our population. So it always starts with people who can't really speak for themselves. It always starts with, you know, people who are in prison or people who are suffer from a disability of some kind, groups that really don't have huge, huge constituencies. And then, as you can see with the healthcare bill, this is just about poor people generally. And that's the reason that you don't let these things happen, because they tend to be slippery slopes. And they get to a point where you can't recover from it, and you can never make it better.
Okay, Andrea Cabral. This is every now and again, and you're learning this on Boston Public Radio too, you get stories that you're really excited to talk about.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is one
He's really revved up.
Marjorie tried to stifle me. She said, "Oh, I don't want to talk about that. We had to arm wrestle for this one about the world's first operational police robot in Dubai." So I'm fascinated by this because this is so interesting. So they have this robot, and there's going to be a whole series, including one that can run up to 80 miles an hour in a couple of years. But you can go up to the robot, and where is it? You can click on buttons, dead
yes.
body entry permit,
yeah.
or to request to open a criminal case, to report human trafficking crimes, or a detainee visit, or just to whom it may concern. So I'm fascinated by this because this is obviously the beginning of the robot army
yeah.
that we
yeah.
saw in Terminator.
Yeah,
this
right.
is it right here, is
it's
it not?
You're absolutely right. It's like an automated everything, right? So
look
it's not just
thing.
That they're going to make, you know, your burgers and stuff when you go to, you know, Hardee's and Sonic or whatever it is. But I first of all, they just, they look like robots, right? So they kind of, I think the article even said that that the particular one they have a picture of looks like Jason Voorhees.
Yes!
Friday the 13th. Yeah! Which is not exactly what, you know, little kids, yeah, I would think would be screaming and run away, you know. But I think that it's a way, and I don't know what the crime rate is in Dubai. I think they have fairly strict punishments.
Yeah, so, that's right. Chop off your hand.
Right. I'm not sure that they have the same kind of crime rate that we have. But can you imagine if these things? Can you imagine the vandalism
of the robot?
Of the robot.
I am not going anywhere near one of these robots.
I don't think they're going to be armed, right?
Not
they're
right
not going
now.
To like RoboCop kind of a
no,
thing.
No, no guns.
They could, like,
not
so
yet.
They're defenseless.
Cut to us in 20 years, though.
Well, that's where I think it's going. I think it would definitely start off as more of an English Bobby type of policeman, and then rapidly grow into, like, you know, Peter Weller in RoboCop. At some point, I agree with you. I think that's probably what's going to happen. Some sort of automated law enforcement vehicle where people can at least at the beginning report things and get some feedback or something.
You know, people should look this up, Google this. It's in Forbes magazine, RoboCop Dubai. This is the weirdest looking thing I've ever seen. It's got just these two, like, holes in its head for eyes.
It's the Jason mask.
Yeah, exactly. And there's no, exactly. It's no nose, no mouth. It is so weird
looking.
It'll
evolve, though. I think it'll become very lifelike. If this catches on in places, mm-hmm, you know, closer to home, I think making it look as human as possible, you know,
so kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Terminator kind of deal.
But even that one, when you say, hi, how are you? It says, I'm fine, thank you very much.
I know.
Like it says, I'm fine. Which makes you think it's a human, but it's not really.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe the running 80 miles an hour would be good to apprehend
that
the suspects.
That I want to see. I want to see one of these things, like, run 80 miles. Can you imagine if you were being chased, like if you just stole something?
And
you're running, and it's like a robot. People would just stop and laugh and point at you.
Yeah,
that you were being chased by.
And you wonder how they catch you too. Do they sort of thrust your hands behind your back and cuff you? I mean, how do they apprehend you? Do they tackle you? I don't know.
Well, you know, it's also a robot. I mean, part of that, when you're being chased by an officer is making decisions about where you're going to go, and when you move, how they're going to move. I'm not sure how you program a robot to be flexible enough and agile enough and anticipatory enough to be able to actually stop. I mean, unless you say to criminals, you pass a law that says from now on you will only run in a straight line, you won't deviate, and when it gets really close to you, you will simply stop. I don't know how you kind of...
Well,
I don't know.
Just look at how smart Siri has gotten, how snarky Siri has gotten. So if they can do that with Siri, I can mark my words. This is the beginning right now.
Yeah, no, you're probably right.
Okay.
And look how, by the way, look how interested Marjorie got after she tried to not get me to talk about this.
No, you were right. I was wrong.
She's dying to talk to her first robot.
This is the future. Well, I figured it was Dubai. You know, I figured it hadn't come. I mean, Bill Evans isn't talking about the Boston Police Department. We don't have to see any RoboCops out here in the corner of Boylston and Exeter Street.
I'll be excited when Dubai is its first female RoboCop.
Yeah.
Okay, so Andrea Cabral, former sheriff of Suffolk County, I don't think you're a big fan of David Clark. He's the Milwaukee County Sheriff, David Clark.
I believe I referred to him as loathsome the last time
loathsome.
I was here.
Yeah, but tell us about him. He got a job in the Homeland Security Post. I believe it was the old job of Juliet Kyan, was with us every Wednesday.
Yeah.
But he has rescinded his acceptance. So tell us a little bit about why you find him loathsome and what you make of the fact that he has rescinded his job in the Homeland Security Department.
Well, I think it was probably strongly suggested to him that he rescind.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, people didn't even believe that he had actually been offered the job because he sort of announced it prematurely. And Department of Homeland Security, their first response was, we have not officially offered anybody anything, so it seemed as though he had jumped the gun. And because he was bragging, he gave people tons of lead time for stories about what a terrible sheriff he is to spread all across the country and for DHS to be inundated, flooded with people sending the messages saying this is absolutely outrageous that the federal government would consider hiring this guy. But they actually did send him a letter, which has been online, offering him the job, and now he's saying that, you know, he's withdrawing it. I think what that means is that there was too much heat to hire him for DHS. He just met with Trump, I think, last week. He is a gigantic Trump supporter, and I think Trump's just going to find a place to put him in the administration that does not require any sort of anything beyond the mere appointment. But
yeah.
I don't think that they're going to, I don't think for a second that, that the federal government has seen the last of David Clark, which is genuinely sad.
Because Trump just, this is a cynical thing with Trump. He just thinks that he was a big supporter of him, and so he got a lot of kudos at the Republican convention.
Oh, yeah.
And he's an African-American. He's got almost no African-Americans in his inner circle, so maybe this is sort of like that kind of cynicism as well.
I don't think that Donald Trump cares that a man died of thirst in
his
jail after being intentionally deprived of water for 7 days, a mentally ill man. Died of thirst. I don't think that he cares that a woman had, a pregnant inmate had her baby on the floor of a cell and the baby subsequently died. I don't think that he cares that someone died of asthma in this man's jail. And I don't think that he cares about any of the other things that he's sort of been accused of doing, including using his position as sheriff to a guy who confronted him in an airport, just said something, one or two sentences. When the airplane landed, he had sheriff's deputies approach him. This is a seizure under the Constitution. Stopping, if I'm acting under color of state law and I stop you and make you answer questions, I'm detaining you under the Constitution. He had them stop this guy. He texted them. That's how they know he did it. He texted him from the plane and said, this is the guy. He's getting off. Stop him and ask him why he spoke to me like that. It's a huge abuse of power. I mean, there's nothing. When I said loathsome, I don't say that about people all that often. I genuinely meant that in every aspect and everything that's been written about this guy, that's the word that comes to mind. And why he should ever work for the federal government is beyond me, but then there's a lot of that.
So, Andrea, one quick thing before you go. The big race between John Ossoff and Karen Handel down in the suburb outside of Atlanta, Georgia. I think it's the most expensive race ever. Ossoff is the
Democrat. Congressional
race, yeah. And I think you had been helping him out earlier on.
Yeah.
So... if he wins, I know the Democrats are going to be very happy about it. If he loses, what's the takeaway?
Well, the first takeaway is say goodbye to your health care.
You think it's going to be a big...
She'll vote for the bill.
Okay.
I'm sure of that.
Okay.
And I think she's a reliable vote for the bill. She's made that very, very clear. But she's also, you know, sort of a reliable... supporter of the administration on a number of other things that are somewhat unsavory. So I think it'll be close, but I think, and I very much hope that he will win. But I think that's the immediate impact of her winning is what will happen with the health care bill.
Okay. I think Jared, Mr. Robot over there, has got something to tell you before you go, Andrea.
We have an update in the robot wars that apparently there is one at the Prudential Center just right up the street from us.
Look at this.
It's described as an oversized Roomba.
Oversized Roomba.
It's 78 miles an hour slower than the upcoming one in Dubai. It just goes.
You know what? Now that I see this, there's a Megan Johnson on Twitter tweeted that she was sitting in the Prudential. She's like sitting there on her phone or having a sandwich or something. And she kind of tweeted that there was this thing watching her. And it was this thing.
Well, she's very suspicious.
Oh, my
suspicious.
God. Yeah, right. Oh, my
she's
God.
She's one of the funniest people I know.
I did not know there were robots at the Prue.
Yeah. I don't know what they do, though.
I don't know.
Like, why do you need them? Are they picking? They're not picking up trash.
I have
right?
no idea what
I'm
they're
sure
doing.
I'm sure they're
we'll
collecting
to...
your DNA and they're creating little Jareds and Andreas and Marjories right now.
That could happen.
Well, we'll have to go down to the Prue and check that out. We're right near the Prue, actually. We can just zip right down after the show and do some investigative reporting.
All right. Well, Andrea Cabral, always a pleasure.
All right. Always a pleasure to see you guys. Be well.
Andrea Cabral joins us every week. Of course, you can catch up with her on Sundays for BPR Weekend. Very exciting right here at the BPL on 89.7, noon to 1. Coming up in the 21st century, does Pride Month and the myriad parades and celebrations still belong to the queer? Or is there some cultural appropriation going on? Sue O'Connell joins us for that and more. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live at the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library, and Executive Arts Editor here at WGBH, Jared Bowen, is sitting in for Jim Browdy. And joining us to go over the social norms and abnormalities of the day is media maven Sue O'Connell.
That's me, baby.
That's right. Among many things, she's the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Sue O'Connell, great to see you. Thank you very much for coming in.
This is my first time here
at
the Boston Public Library WGBH broadcast, and I feel like I'm at a Senate hearing sitting here with my two questioners ready to go.
I think it's very swank and swish and posh.
It is.
I do.
It's,
I love this
delightful.
Studio. It is gorgeous. And if people don't know, we have windows. What would you say? These are like 35 feet
high? It's amazing.
If you haven't been
to the Boston Public Library, you need to come in, because the changes that have happened here,
fantastic.
It's just tremendous.
It's gorgeous.
And they have this beautiful little courtyard out here that is wonderful to sit out in this
lovely
weather.
If I ever get married, I will get married there.
They do weddings here, you know.
I know. I will get married
there. And then plus they have tea in the afternoon, and it's absolutely a wonderful tea service.
I can't wait to be at your wedding.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll date someone, and then we can move right ahead there on that. I'm never getting married. Never, never. Totally against it.
Keep hope alive. Media maven over there. So media maven Sue O'Connell. I had not thought much about this. I had not thought about a lot of these things we're going to talk about today, and I should have. But if Anthony Kennedy retires and the famed swing vote on the United States Supreme Court, I'm just reading this story this morning about what could happen to gay rights in a transfigured Supreme Court. What could happen?
Well, I think it's important if we're going to look at something as an example, I think the Roe v. Wade ruling is a way to look at it, that it's settled law, but we never feel completely that it's settled law. It's always up for debate. It always seems up for a vote in some way. And with LGBT rights, especially the right to marriage, although it is settled law, it's not that far away from the Supreme Court just deciding, well, we want to revisit it, or maybe we made a mistake. The difference, I think, which is a pro and should give us some comfort, is that it's been voted on. Their voters have. It's not just been a ruling based on the Supreme Court. It's been a ruling on judges in states and lower courts. It's been votes that people have gone to the ballot to vote on. So it's a multi-pronged right that has been institutionalized. However, I don't really feel any great complete comfort that the right to marriage or other rights that are associated to LGBT civil rights wouldn't be eroded, especially on the lower courts. And, you know, if we've talked about this a billion times, this religious right, the right to not serve someone based on what your beliefs are, and if the customer's beliefs are in opposition to yours, that's another huge area for people to really lose ground. So, you know, like anything else in America, it could change. It could take a while. I'm not as totally concerned about it as the author of this report writes about, but it's definitely not something that you can go to bed at night and think it's totally solid.
Right. In these cases, people often go back to the states' rights and looking at where it falls with states. And just from February, Texas was looking at benefits for same-sex couples. Still, after same-sex marriage has been acknowledged in this country,
right, and we don't
Texas
have a federal protection law for LGBT people. We don't have that layer either. And a lot of people think, well, you have the right to marriage, so you don't need that right. There are still places you can get fired if people think that your employer thinks that you're gay. So there's a lot of soft spots in the protections. But again, I think if we look just at marriage and that level of civil rights, because it's been voted on by the people, there's been rulings by judges, there have been lawmakers who have voted on it. And, you know, a difference is I think it will be very hard to undo it, especially if the people fighting to keep the right are my kids. You know, I mean, our children are now going to be old enough to fight for the rights of their gay and lesbian parents.
Well, you know, you mentioned Roe v. Wade, and it's very interesting. The analogy, I think, is totally apt because Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973, abortion up to 6 months, but the chipping away at it, and effectively, in many states, you have to drive hundreds of miles.
You can go to another state to get an
abortion, you have to wait 24 hours when you're there, or the doctor has to show you a picture of some ultrasound or something.
And if you look at Great Britain, right, where their reproductive rights and right to terminate a pregnancy was brought about more in the way that same-sex marriage was here in the United States, where it was both by voting and by judges' decisions, so that it's a lot more firmly set because of the different planks that went into it, whereas with Roe v. Wade, you just have a ruling. You didn't have people vote on it. I'm not saying we should put it to a vote, but, you know, it's a much more complicated weave that's holding it in place for
same-sex
marriage.
Yeah, and the same
marriage.
Thing, I mean, you could have this sort of situation where, you can get married, but you have to go to Arizona to
get married,
or something like that.
Right, or you can't get states, you know, benefits if you're married, or a self-funding insurer can deny you and your spouse benefits because they are religiously opposed to you, so you'd have to get health care from the government. Oh, no, wait, you can't. Never mind. I'm only kidding.
So this is fascinating. This is a conversation that no one would be having 20 years ago. This piece that was in the New York Times in the Sunday Review just this past week, is pride still for queer people like me?
Oh, we've been having this discussion for 50 years, but not in the New York Times.
Well,
I think as soon as there was the discussion on this article is that that the writer is saying I feel a little too queer to be involved in this corporate pride that happens now.
Right. Mainly this started a celebration among queer people, and now she talks about walking into Target and finds all of the pride paraphernalia, the rainbows and whatnot, and suddenly it's been, as we were saying in our open, has it been appropriated?
Right, and she's both crying with joy and then feeling that, you know, they just want her money, which I think you can do both of those things and feel it. I think as soon as it stopped being a pride in general, stopped being a purely political event, those feelings have happened. You know, there's always a battle, as there should be, of parts of the gay community to try and make sure that they're being represented. You know, the LGBTQ, whether it's of color or Latino, Latin, you know, everybody wants to be included, so they're fighting to get in there. But at the same time, there's always people who feel that the essence, the political activism, the sexual deviancy, if you will, of being gay, is being left behind the Montessori schools that are marching and the banks that are marching and the accountants that are marching, you know. And it's hard to have both when you have these huge celebrations, you know. I mean, not long ago, maybe 15 years ago, we had the Bedgate issue, where you had the mayor of Boston, Mayor Menino at the time, marching in gay pride, and behind them, a lesbian group, I think it was the Lesbian Avengers, entered illegally into the parade with a big bed that simulated women having sex on the bed, not too far behind Mayor Menino. And it was called Bedgate, right? And the Herald, of course, just focused on the Bedgate. And then you sort of had this example of people saying, well, I want, you know, my straight grandmother to go to Pride, but I also want to be able to express my individualism and what I think makes me queer or what I'm proud of. I think, you know, the writer of this makes a good argument at the end that you both need to have Budweiser and Miller Lite doing happy, soft-focus Budweiser ads for gay pride, and at the same time acknowledge the political aspect of it and the identity of it. You know, what makes us LGBT is our sexual expression, if you will, so an orientation.
It does sound like there's a bachelorette party component to
it
now.
Well, it's true. It's like Jacques, the great drag bar in Bay Village, what used to be a drag bar, and now it's every bachelorette party stop in the world. You go out there Saturday night and you're picking drunk bachelorettes up off the ground with their little crowns on and their sashes, and it's not a gay bar anymore.
But, you know, wouldn't you be having the same argument? It would be different, obviously, if this were a straight person's parade, because if you had people in a bed having straight sex, grandma might be a little freaked out by that.
Well, it depends on what it's for, though. What's the you know, what are you trying to express?
Right.
You know, and the idea of the other, the idea of the identity of being queer, you know, which is a term that once was derogatory and then taken back in the mid-'80s as, you know, I'm here, I'm queer, get used to it. You know, there's still a sex-positive aspect of the gay community that doesn't want to just get married and send their kid to a suburban school and, you know, never talk about sex again, like, you know, a lot of other people.
get married right here in the Boston Public
yeah,
Library.
Right here, you know.
So what's the solution?
I think the solution is to just keep talking about it and okay. to understand that it's also, you know, that's why you have a Pride Month or you have a, you know, the Boston Gay Pride has a week-long celebration of things so that other aspects of the community, not just, you know, what you represent but what you believe can be represented. I'll also note, you know, Boston Gay Pride, when they publish their Pride, they don't even call it LGBT Pride anymore. They just call it Boston Pride. You know, there's been this elimination of the gayness from it a little bit. So, you know, it's now this big corporate city, state supported event, which I completely agree with. But at the same time, you know, you're putting this wash on it to make it an event that your grandmother can go to.
Jim is hitting all of the Pride events around the country. That's why
is
he's
that
not,
where
here.
He is right now?
It's his,
not here.
It's his marathon mission
North
this
Shore
year.
North Shore Pride is this weekend up in Salem, so he can be there.
Okay. So we're going to take a little European diversion here before we come back to the United States. Things are happening that Sue is concerned about. What's going on in Serbia?
Oh, well, good things are happening in Serbia. Anna Brnabic, you should say that, Marjorie.
I'm not even. That's why I asked you, Sue.
She is the president of Serbian's Choice to succeed him as prime minister, and she is an LGBT person. She's a lesbian. And this is a country where 65% of the Serbians believe that homosexuality is an illness, and 78% believe that homosexuality should not be expressed outside the homes, yet they are about to get a lesbian prime minister. So that's a great leap forward for Serbia and for the Balkans and in Europe in general.
But what's the story behind it? If they have these backward views of gays and lesbians, how did she get elected?
She is one of those lifelong politicians who has served and, you know, just shown up and done her job. According to the reports, people are surprised by the fact that she's a lesbian and she'd be the prime minister, but not by the fact that it's her. You know, so this would be another example of your good work overcoming any challenges. And if she does a good job, I bet those numbers will be totally opposite in the next 5 years or so.
Well, as we continue our globetrotting.
Globetrotting, that's right.
Where
getting exhausted
in the world is the Zumba class endangered right now?
Well, you know, Zumba, I had no idea it had Colombian roots, which is what I learned from this.
Yeah,
but over in
Iran.
Is it Iran? I
yes.
want to make sure, because I always say Iraq when I mean Iran, or
yeah,
Iran when
Iran.
I mean Iraq. Where there are lots of rules about things that women can and cannot do. Women can't go to sports events. They can't go to stadiums to sports events. There are sporting events they can't participate in. And there was this rule that came down that Zumba dance classes should be prohibited. Women should not attend them because of the motions and the way that people dance. And this had one of those, you know, there's always a moment, I think, in prejudice or bigotry or stupidity mm-hmm. when it just crosses over. And even people who might agree with you about, yes, women shouldn't do things, look at you and go, really, Zumba? Is that what we're going to ban? That was the next thing on your list to ban Zumba. And there were some great Twitter explosions that happened. You know, somebody was asking if the minister of Colombia was going to leave Iran now that because Zumba's was originated in Colombia. It's just a crazy, crazy thing. But I think it has had a positive impact. I don't know what the status is right now.
Well, it raises a lot of big questions. I mean, you wonder, okay, if they're upset about Zumba and the dance steps, mm-hmm. I mean, where do they come down on step aerobics, for example, that was all the rage, you know, a while back, or SoulCycle. Everybody's with the music is pounding. You're there at the SoulCycle.
Well,
have you done SoulCycle, Sue?
I did, actually. I've done SoulCycle twice and
really?
Lived to tell the tale.
Oh,
yes, I have. Yes,
I did a SoulCycle class just once. You know how they strap your feet in.
You can't get out.
Happily, they put you in the back of the class.
No, I sit in the front when I was a beginner.
You did?
I sit right in the front.
Oh, my God. You are
and I
brave.
Say, I'm not doing anything I don't want to do.
Yeah.
But, the serious issue here is, again, the complete, holding down of women being able to express themselves and live a normal life, go to a sporting event and take a Zumba class. But
have you done Zumba?
I have not done a Zumba class.
Have you done SoulCycle?
I did a spin class. Is that the same thing?
No.
No.
Oh, no.
No,
no, no. no.
Look
no.
who's turned the tables now.
SoulCycle is a cult.
It is kind of a cult. And
what's the difference between SoulCycle and...
You get,
it's much more intense.
It's very intense. You know, they have you make more motion than you do in spin, which is useless because scientific surveys show that you can only burn so many calories at a time. So
you're in the dark.
But they make you feel, you know, have feelings and say nice things to you while you're doing
it. Oh, thus the soul part of the cycle.
Well, they have these teachers with these unbelievable
They're charismatic.
Apps, that you can't believe that people actually have stomachs that look like this. And they're usually in a bare midriff kind of thing. But what I do, what's upsetting, though, is that they strap your feet in.
And you can't get out.
So you're in the back of the class, and I went there with my children, and they're big into this kind of thing. My daughters, anyway, not my son. But anyway, we went to the class, and I was exhausted, like 10 minutes in. So you're furiously pedaling, you know, to keep up with everybody next to you. Then you try
I don't do that.
You try to stop pedaling.
I don't do that. I just do what I want to do.
Well, your feet
But then they yell at you.
No, there's no yelling.
No, there's not no yelling.
In the spin class I did, they yelled.
We could do none of this in Iran. I just want to bring us back to that point.
How about Pilates?
But I feel like I cut off
Pilates. I've done Pilates.
Yeah.
That to me seems more torturous than the spinning. Yeah. The spinning.
Okay. Well, we have to stand up for Zumba here because I think it's changed lives all around America. Okay, we're back to the United States.
Whew.
Funeral dogs.
Totally. I think there should just be dogs everywhere.
This is a gold. We have a story about Tucker, the golden retriever, who's been comforting mourners at the Gately Funeral Home in Melrose for 9 years. Mm-hmm. And as the guy from the funeral home says, Dwyer Funeral Home, he says the presence of the dog changes the mood. He talks about a little girl who was very upset at her grandmother's funeral. The dog walked out, followed the little girl, sat down beside her. The tears stopped pretty quickly. It was a wonderful thing. So should we incorporate a canine?
I'm all for the canine thing. As long as this is where I'll stand in for Jim Browdy, I think there should be more government involvement in licensing these types of animals, both as comfort dogs, emotional dogs. I just don't want any random dog. Mm-hmm. I want a dog that has been authorized, tested, and licensed to be a comfort dog. Like the dogs at the
Are you serious?
I am. At Boston Children's Hospital, they have a great program. You know, my kid's been a frequent flyer at Children's. And when she's been in there and they have the dogs come in, it's enormously wonderful and great. But they're vetted and tested and safe. And I think if you want to have a funeral home dog, I think you should. But I think there should be some government regulation on it.
Because that's what we need, more processes.
Yes.
Are you suspicious of the number of comfort dogs
absolutely.
You see popping up everywhere?
I absolutely
am. I am, too.
Am.
I think you can send away a thing online.
I'm sure they're comforting for you. Yeah. And I don't disagree with the idea that a pet makes you feel better and a dog.
Right.
But I am concerned about people who have dog allergies. I've been around animals my whole life. I know that some animals should not be in public spaces, you know, hanging out with a bunch of people, and I don't want someone to take advantage of that because they're blinded about how much their dog loves them.
Well, I guess I was asking with skepticism, thinking that that vetting would be done by the dog owner. Hopefully that would be already, but no, I guess
it can't be done by, I mean, you know.
And I like that there actually have been studies done that show that there is a change in the brain once you encounter an animal, a dog, and it does have an effect.
No, I could see a very nice dog at the funeral home. If you wanted the dog to
be there,
you would certainly want other kinds of dogs. I mean, I wouldn't be comfortable.
I mean, I sent my daughter to a daycare. Where they had a dog. They had a setter, a golden retriever, and it was great. It was a great experience. But there are more rules about going into a public dog park than there are about you bringing your comfort dog into a store. If you go down to the south end of Peters Park, there's a whole list of rules. Your dog has to be licensed. It has to have its rabies shot. It has to be leashed. And people just walk around with these little sweaters on their dogs saying they're comfort dogs, and I don't believe them.
Well,
my dog is not a comfort dog.
I'm changing your title from media maven to canine curmudgeon, Sue O'Connell.
I'm pro dog. I'm just also pro people.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Sue O'Connell, media maven. Always nice to see you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Canine curmudgeon Sue O'Connell joins us regularly. She's the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Always great to speak with you. Coming up, it's a jungle out there. What does Amazon's appropriation of Whole Foods mean for jobs, for our food policy, and for our wallet? Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for that. Stay tuned on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live today from the Boston Public Library at the corner of Boylston and Exeter Street. And boy, I wonder if you can get a suntan in here. I feel the sun on my back. Should I have worn my sunscreen down here to the Boston Public
Library? I think so. I feel like it's pretty warm in here, actually.
Yeah, okay.
It's nice to see the sun. I'm not going to...
All right, Jared is perspiring. Okay, so when Jeff Bezos conceptualized his online empire, he named it Amazon to convey the scale of his retail behemoth. Behemoth, thank you, and to give it an alphabetical advantage on the web. And in appropriating Whole Foods, he's not only met his alphabetical opposite, but a mega franchise that managed to cultivate a touchy-feely culture with a socially and environmentally conscious vibe. So what's next for the Whole Food brand, its employees, and the customers who've come to know it as the grocer next door? Joining us for her take on this is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. She holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. I'm so glad to be talking to you about this today, Nancy, because I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing. I don't really understand why it happened, so I'm hoping you can straighten this out for us. I live like a half a block from a Whole Foods, and I spend more time in there than I should, but I like it. So first, why did this happen? Why did Amazon come in and take over Whole Foods?
So just to refresh our listeners' memories here, last week, Amazon announced it would pay $13.7 billion for 431 stores that constitute the Whole Foods empire. It was by far and away Amazon's biggest acquisition. It is roiling the grocery store industry. And I think there are a number of reasons, and probably some that are unknown. This is partly a bet, right, as any acquisition this big would be for even a company as large and ambitious as Jeff Bezos' company, Amazon. Some really obvious things, I think, or first blush things that I think Amazon gets as a result of buying this company. First, it gets you, Marjorie Egan. It gets an educated, urban, right, in general, high income, highly connected, highly educated customer base.
Very sophisticated, well-dressed, stunning.
It is you.
Seriously, you know, it gets you because you are a loyal Whole Foods customer. I don't know, do you shop at Whole Foods, Jared?
I do.
And so you now are part of, you now immediately become part of Amazon's customer base. You may already shop at Amazon, but now they are located very, very close to you. So that all those customers, and P.S., something that hasn't been talked about very much, is the millennials. 24% of all American millennials shopped at Whole Foods last year. So those are a very important cohort of customers, and they now come into the Amazon fold even more deeply if they're already in, and if they're not, they come into the fold right through this acquisition. So first is about customers. Second is about location. They're close to your house. So if they want to turn some of these stores into not only stores but distribution centers for their already burgeoning grocery business, this is a great way to do it. Jeff Bezos has been in the grocery store business for a long time. He's been trying to make bigger and bigger inroads in them. Amazon Fresh, right, which is their grocery store business in lots of cities now.
Excuse me for a second. What is Amazon Fresh? Does that mean you order it and it comes to your house?
Yeah.
You
can order anything you want. It comes right to your house. In some places, it'll come to your house like most grocery stores did 25 years ago in New York in an hour.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So he's had big designs on the grocery store business for a long, long time. Some of those were not successful early on. This Amazon Fresh has been much more successful. This is like putting, you know, high octane fuel into that piece of his business, and it provides again these places where he can get very, very close to you and you locationally in terms of delivering stuff, because he's now got 431 stores, 30 of which are in Massachusetts. So that's a second thing that's really important. I think a third thing that really is really important is they get this fabulous living laboratory. Right, you like to go to Whole Foods.
I do.
Right? You enjoy it. You spend time in there.
I like to hang around looking at the produce, you know. I like to stand there, even though it is expensive, the produce there. I like to stand there looking at this time of year, especially the nectarines, the white nectarines, the orange nectarines, the peaches, the organic
raspberries.
I mean, you feel like the air is somehow more healthy in there because the store is so beautiful.
And P.S., that's exactly what he wants, because... Try your Amazon Fresh. It's much harder to sell organic tomatoes on the internet than it is to sell it through Whole Foods. And P.S., everyone that's ever been in a Whole Foods store is more likely to buy those raspberries now online from Whole Foods, right? They're not going to change the name from Whole Foods than they were from Amazon Fresh. So you are the living, you know, you're like Exhibit A for why he's doing this. I think there's something else too. So they can experiment with restaurants because there's a lot of eat-in and take-out that goes in those salad bars at Whole Foods and their dining options. And I think there's another thing they can do with these stores is they can start bringing their Amazon. They have Amazon brands online. So just like Whole Foods has, you know, 365,
yeah,
right? They have their own brand. So now here's a great, great outlet, 431 outlets for their own brands. P.S., I think we'll see the prices fall in Whole Foods stores as they integrate lower price merchandise
Can I just stop here? Yeah. That's what I'm really curious about. As you start to drill down and understand what Amazon is doing here, and it sounds like Amazon does want to make Whole Foods this more democratic experience because, let's be honest, its nickname is Whole Paycheck.
Right.
It's inaccessible to a whole sector of people.
So the nectarines are very
expensive.
They had
that ridiculous, what was it, asparagus water fiasco a couple of years ago where they were... I think that was true, right? That
wasn't
because
it.
There have also been pranks about other, jokes online about other things, ridiculous things that people would pay so much money for. But it sounds like that may be dismantled here with the way Amazon starts to envision constructing Whole Foods from here on out.
That's what a whole score of newspaper reports and chatting, the chattering classes, the analysts and observers of the grocery business are talking about, right? That Whole Foods will now democratize. The shopping experience Amazon will now democratize the shopping experience in Whole Foods by bringing in cheaper goods, right, their own goods, right, changing the merchandise mix in Whole Foods so you may have fewer perfect nectarines, but you may have cheaper nectarines. I suspect they won't really mess very much with the quality of the produce because that's such an important draw for people. And P.S., it's a very high margin section of the store. The reason it occupies so much space in Whole Foods, just like takeout food or prepared food, is because those are the places that generate the most income in the store. So I don't think Amazon will mess with that a lot. But I think there's one other piece here, and that is they can experiment, and this is what's getting lots and lots of press right now. They can experiment with technology in these stores in new ways. And I don't really think drones are going to be kind of flying out of Whole Foods, carrying kale anytime soon. I really don't think that's going to happen, really. But it's possible we could see some of the technology they've used in other petri dishes in their empire. One of the stores that they have created that I would really urge our listeners to go Google is Amazon Go. This is a new concept they've been testing in Seattle. It's been very, very popular. These are very small 2,000 square foot outlets where you can buy prepared foods and things like yogurt, the kind of foods we take with us and eat on the run, and there are no cashiers. So you walk in, you load the app for Amazon Go as you walk in the store on your smartphone, and you have a cart or mostly baskets, and you pick things up. And as you put it in the basket, it gets recorded on your phone. And then you say, no, I don't want raspberry. I want blueberry yogurt. So you put it back, and then it comes immediately off your phone. And then you put the blueberry in, and it goes back on your phone. And then when you leave the store, just as you walk out the door, you get a receipt from Amazon that says this has all been charged to the credit card you have on file on Amazon. And it is, it's been very, very successful for them. So will they do things like that in Whole Foods, experiment, right, with technology and labor, and particularly labor-saving technology? I think that's a pretty good bet. There are 90,000 very decently compensated, right, very a career-building employees at Whole Foods. It's a great employer. A very progressive set of policies. And are those people vulnerable? Not in the short term. In the longer term, maybe. So I think that's another way they might experiment and another way the experience may change, not very quickly, but over time.
We're talking to Nancy Kane, historian from the Harvard Business School, about Amazon's takeover of Whole Foods. There was a very interesting piece about this in the New York Times, talking about John Mackey, the guy that founded this, described him as, sort of a big hippie type, anti-greed type. This sounds like that there was a lot of hostility before this Amazon. Talk about the business aspect of this whole takeover.
So it's important for the backstory here is really interesting. So John Mackey, I actually wrote a case on John Mackey many years ago at HBS on Whole Foods because I was so fascinated by this. He's very much an iconoclastic, highly intelligent, you know, in many ways, very progressive business leader. Just a couple examples there. First, about 8 years ago, he announced, I will take no more salary as CEO. I intend to stay CEO, but I'm going to pay myself a dollar. We're going to pay me a dollar a year. No stock, no cash. I've made enough money. Now,
wow.
That puts him in a universe of one among American.
How much money has he made? Several million, I would assume.
I have no idea. But when I kind of thought really strategically about it, I'm going to put it at somewhere north of $30 million and south of 50. That's just a very rough bulk.
Okay.
You know, a sizable amount of money. But so have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of CEOs, some of whom draw more than that down every year, and they're not talking about. And that's the first thing. Second thing, Whole Foods employees hold the majority of the employee-granted stock, unlike most public corporations where the top five people in management hold the majority of employee-granted stock. Non-employees throughout the organization, particularly non-management, hold lots and lots of stock. So he's an interesting guy. Those were policies that he pushed. He also hates unions and doesn't want them in the company. So he's just an interesting guy who breaks lots of stereotypes, very creative, very serious, very competitive. And he didn't want to sell this business. But what happened was sales had been flat, profit has been flat or shrinking over the last several years. And his company, public company, came under activist investor pressure over the last year. Two firms, Neuberger Berman, I think that's right, Neuberger Berman, and then Jaina Partners took big stakes beginning late last year in the company and started pushing to get changeovers in boards, changes in strategy. And Mackey was furious. Absolutely furious. They're not going to force me to sell my company. I'm not going to. I'm running a company the way I want to run it, etc. And he wasn't immune to the pressure. He wasn't digging his heels in the sand obstreperously. But he was not happy, as lots and lots of CEOs aren't, when activist investors enter the stage and put pressure on him. And so what happened over the last several months is, he I think basically said, if I'm going to try and hold on to this company and still have agency as a leader, I got to find another way here. And so what they did is they went looking for buyers. And there were some changes in board membership generated by investor pressure. And over the last couple of months, very, very quickly, some suitors lined up, Amazon being at the top of the list. And then this announcement, which came again very, very quickly in terms of the process of selling the company. And I think as something of a surprise to a lot of folks who held a lot of stock in the company. So incidentally, those activist investors that bought recently made a sizable amount of money given the stock price that was paid for this. And Whole Foods stock jumped about almost 30% on the announcement. Other grocers' stock, interestingly enough, fell significantly. Investors believing that this puts Whole Foods in a position at the front of the market.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you, because we know the Amazon creep. We know what it did to the book industry. We know what it's the record industry. Exactly. We know they're in deep competition with Walmart, and that would probably fed a lot of this too, because Walmart has a big part of the food market. And when you read this, and you know how Amazon is changing the way we shop, the way we buy, that you can turn your home into a supermarket virtually by putting little barcodes and all the things that you use regularly, like dish detergent, or maybe now bananas or milk. How profoundly do you think this is going to change the way we buy and consume food in this country?
I think it'll have significant effects. I don't think it's going to be a huge step function. I think it will be a slight acceleration in the evolution of food buying that's been happening in some sense for 30 or 40 years. Since women poured into the workforce, Americans have spent much more money every 10 years on food prepared outside the home. So that's been happening for a long time. E-commerce, or buying food online and having it delivered, in some sense, is as old as, you know, grocery stores that you called up in the 1930s to bring your groceries over, except we don't do it on the phone. We do it on our computers or our smartphones. So I don't think this is brand new. I think it's going to accelerate slightly a set of changes that are well in place and continuing as part of a large sectoral shift in how we shop. Again, you know, 100 years ago, Sears brought out the Sears Roebuck catalog, and that changed retailing, right, on the prairies and in places in places that weren't cities. This is not completely dissimilar from that. So retailing is these cycles of revolution, and here we're in another cycle, and Amazon is a big, if you will, accelerator in that.
You know, Nancy Kane, Harvard Business School historian, I don't know if you saw this story from the Washington Post about baking powder. Did you see this story?
I did. You better give a little background for our listeners.
This was incredible. You're
Marjorie.
Talking about the history of supermarkets, and this story talking about Amazon. The headline is from A&P to Amazon, and they talk about how the beginning of grocery stores can be traced back to a common kitchen product, baking powder, because the A&P was initially called Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. And because baking powder was very important to kitchens, it made bread rise faster, that sort of thing. But people were selling, you know, it reminds me of people with the bad drugs, you know, in the street selling these bad drugs cut with things. Well, I guess people were unscrupulous sellers were selling bad baking powder that didn't do the job.
Right.
So the A&P labeled it and sold it.
Yes. So again, think back, dear listeners, to a time before the FDA, before a lot of consumer activism around safe food. America was very much a pioneer in this effort among lots of nations. And baking soda, pickles, all kinds of products, flour, sugar, were often adulterated. And you couldn't trust your general. Pa Ingalls couldn't trust, or Ma Ingalls couldn't trust, from Little House on the Prairie, couldn't trust their local general store to necessarily have good products or safe products. So that was a really important void, a really important issue. One of the critical things that people like Henry Heinz, who figured out how to brand safe condiments, or the Great Atlantic and the Pacific Tea Company did, was say, trust our brand. We're going to expand our brand, because A&P was primarily a tea company.
Yeah,
and
I didn't know that.
And baking soda helped wrench them into grocery store retailing. And what they did was take the safety and certainty and a predictability of the brand as it was attached to tea and apply it to baking soda. Henry Heinz did something similar, built his brand around pickles, packaged in clear glass so you could see them. That was going to be part of the safety sell or the safety value proposition. And then factory tours so you could come see how the pickles were made and assure yourself that they were safer and cleaner than the way you would make them at home. Oh, he was really brilliant at this. But that was how A&P, or one way that A&P got into mass retailing and grocery stores, and then built this, you know, thousands of stores. They were like Rexall Drug, one of the biggest chain stores at the turn of the century.
There was something interesting I was reading about the profit margin. They paid so much attention between the 2 and 3%. 3% was too much of a profit margin. What was that?
So again, think back to a time when capitalism had a strategic and not only a strategic face, but a benevolent face to it. So A&P early leaders were very concerned that you not charge too much, because that would not get you the scale you want. It's like Henry Ford saying, I'm not going to charge any more than whatever, you know, $800 for my Model T, because I'd rather sell a million of them at $800 than 400,000 at $950. The idea was, you want a product democratization. Again, Jared, you want a product that's spread across society, and you'll make up much more money on the scale of the thing on a smaller margin than you will on a much smaller scale and a bigger margin. Very interesting, right? Again, a democratic approach to making the money you're going to make as a merchandiser or as a retailer, and that was very important, and it was hugely beneficial to them in building the scale of their retailing business, which of course allows them to sell things, buy things more cheaply from suppliers, move them more cheaply on railroads because they're moving more of them. It was a virtuous cycle for A&P and for consumers.
You know, we only have a couple of minutes left, but in the minutes we do, maybe people want to call in and give their questions to Nancy about the takeover of Whole Foods by Amazon. Our number is 877-301-8970. Yeah. I hope your screen is working, because mine is not, so I can't see who's
unfortunately
calling.
Mine is not working.
Okay,
either.
Well, we need a little help with the screens, and then maybe we can take some calls. 877-301-8970. But I wanted to ask you, too, the experience, though, I guess Jim always talks about how he loves to go to the supermarket. I really hate to go to the supermarket, but I like to go to Whole Foods, like I said, because it makes me feel like a healthy person, even though nothing to do with what I did that day or the other day. So the experience will sort of be the same, but maybe the produce will be... smaller? We don't know yet.
We don't know yet. But if I were Jeff Bezos, and he's, you know, he's smart. I can't imagine he's going to really mess a lot.
Because there's a lot about it.
Yeah.
Even though you look at things you never buy because they have these overpriced candles and overpriced this and overpriced that. Even though the $365 is very reasonable, you just like to look at these things. I like to look at these things.
Absolutely, and you're not alone. I think most regular Whole Foods customers enjoy the experience of going in there. Now, do you want to buy your Poland Springs water and your diapers if you have young children there? Maybe not, right? For pricing and other reasons, you might very efficiently buy on Amazon and have delivered to you. But I don't think they're going to mess with that. Partly because they want to bring in a whole bunch of new customers as well, and those people then want to actually buy some more things online. So remember, the play isn't anymore really about bricks and mortar versus online for smart retailers. Why do you think Amazon bought Jet? Right, for smart retailers, it's about how do you make 1 + 1 = 3, bricks and mortar, right, online, and the possibilities of that.
We've got some callers here. Let's start, Nancy, with James in Westport. James, you're on with Nancy Kane, historian from the Harvard Business School.
Hey, James.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's up?
I'm a small farmer in Westport, 1.5 acres. I have a CSA, do farmer's market. When I hear this news, it doesn't sound good to me. It doesn't sound like it democratizes the food access, especially in urban areas where land is really valuable and a lot of urban farms are being saved. Can you talk about how you expect this kind of a thing to affect local agriculture?
So that's a great question. When Jared and I were talking about democratizing, we were talking, I think, more about pricing for the consumer. But your point, James, is really important. I don't think this is going to have a huge effect on the very powerful and very important local food markets. I think farmers markets and all kinds of stores that are interested in purchasing really local, really fresh produce like that you grow are going to change very much. And P.S., I don't think Bezos is going to say to John Mackey, sorry, you can't go ahead and cultivate local suppliers, as they do in lots of Whole Foods stores where they have signs that say, hey, this came from James's farm.
I love that.
We all love it. So I don't think this is going to hurt the markets that you play in very significantly. And I don't even think that Bezos is going to aim to pull away from this in terms of Whole Foods stores. And besides, Mackey just signed a deal that said, I get to call the shots at Whole Foods. So my answer is don't run for the hills on this. I don't think it's going to have an adverse effect.
James, thank you very much for the call.
Now let's go to George in Woods Hole. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Good, good. I just wanted to caution you guys about using words like democratizing for business, because I think that we think of democracy as inherently, of course, a good thing, but I don't think A&P strategy or Walmart strategy is about democratizing things. Of course, they make products available to the consumer at a good price. It's purely a business strategy. And if you think of A&P's growth, they probably in those days crushed hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of small businesses and retailers.
Okay.
So I just want to caution you there.
Thanks, George. Appreciate the call.
Duly noted, George. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Nancy Kane, this is great. I'm looking forward to, I'm not sure, I hope it's going to be good. Thank you very much.
I think it's going to be okay.
Okay. Thank you.
I look forward to the kale flurry over my house.
The drones with the kale.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Nancy Kane joins us every week. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her forthcoming book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Nancy, always great to speak with you.
Thank you, Nancy.
Coming up, CNN's Chief National Correspondent John King is here to go over the latest headlines. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Well, Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. It's Tuesday, so we are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library. Jared Bowen is in for Jim Brady. So I can't wait to talk to John King. Georgia is on everyone's mind today as Democrats seek to get their first big win in the era of Trump off of the state's special congressional election. But are Democrats prepared for what could be a huge loss next week with the Senate set to vote on their reworked health care bill? Joining us on the line, like I said, I can't wait to talk to him, CNN's chief national correspondent John King, the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock. Hello, John.
Happy Tuesday. Hello, Jared.
Hi there.
So, John, I am dying to know. I mean, everybody's watching this John Ossoff, Karen Handel race in the suburb outside of Atlanta, millions and millions and millions thrown at this race. What happens if John wins? What happens if Karen Handel wins?
I think there'll be we're guaranteed an overreaction, whether that will be, no matter what happens. Look, I think I just want to tell you, I was just talking to a couple of Republicans down there who were doing the turnout operation, and they're cautiously optimistic they're going to squeak this one out. So let me start there, if that's true. And turnout in special elections is incredibly unpredictable. There's also some early voting here, so I think we're going to have a long night, given the history of the counting in this area. They usually go late. So if Karen Handel can hold on and win this race, it will be a huge relief for Republicans. It will be because Trump is unpopular in this district, because Trump struggled in this district in the presidential election, just barely carried it. Mitt Romney won it with 60% of the vote in 2012. Trump just barely won it with high 40s. And so if Republicans can squeak out a win, even by a vote, they're going to declare this a major victory, and it will solve a problem in the Republican Party, which is a lot of House Republican incumbents from reasonably Republican but districts like Georgia 6 thinking they might retire, Marjorie. We're going to learn a lot about potential candidate recruitment and potential retirements down the road from this vote tonight. If the Democrat wins, there are a lot of state legislators out there, a lot of mayors out there who are in Republican districts who are thinking, do I want to risk my career here? If John Ossoff can win, more of those Democrats will be encouraged motivated to get into tough races, thinking, okay, we proved we can win a district like this. I'm going to run next year. And that would help the Democrats take back the House. If the Republicans win, you'll have a big sigh of relief that somehow they pulled this one out despite all this money, more than $50 million combined on a House race.
Yeah.
Think of what you could do with all that money. But they'll be if the Democrats lose, they weren't going to win in Montana. It's too Republican of a district. They were not going to win in Kansas. It's too Republican of a district. This one, on paper, is winnable. If you look at Trump's numbers, if you look at who lives in the region, if you look at the financial and other support they've been able to get in there for John Ossoff, I think you're going to have a despondency in the Democratic base.
Yes.
To pull this one out.
Well, exactly. I think there's going to be a huge despondency because it kind of raises the question, okay, which race can they win? On the other hand, what I've read, John King from CNN, is that Ossoff is not the ideal candidate for a lot of reasons. What's his story?
Forget Trump for a second. Trump is the major issue in this race. Is there a Trump drag? Is Trump so unpopular with moderate suburban Republicans that as many as 30 or 35 Republican seats are at risk next year? That's the big thing you're looking for here. And again, we always overanalyze one particular race, but that is a legitimate question to look at. So is John Ossoff a bad candidate? Well, he doesn't live in the district. He was born in the district. He was raised in the district. He lives in a neighboring district with his girlfriend, and he says he's supporting her during her career, and he's right next door, and it's all perfectly legal. So Karen Handel has run against him, saying, you know, he's a carpetbagger. He doesn't live here. And we've seen this in other elections. It's a perfectly fine thing for her to do, you know, and he has to respond to it. There's nothing wrong with that. So here's the interesting thing. In some ways, if you're a Republican incumbent, you're watching this because Karen Handel is a former Secretary of State, so she's run statewide. She's run for governor and Senate and lost in primaries. She was a Fulton County commissioner. That's one of the largest counties in this congressional district. She is a career politician. She is. Or at least most of her adult life has been spent in politics. John Ossoff was a congressional aide, but he's never held office. So in some ways, he's the Trump in the race. He's the outsider saying it's time to send fresh blood to Washington. If he somehow wins this race against an experienced politician who has won in the district and who is known in the district, if you're a Republican incumbent and you're not sure whether you want to run for re-election, that's going to send a message because you're going to get newcomers in your race. So I do think beyond the Trump dynamic, we're going to learn a lot. So John Ossoff has pluses, back to your question. He has pluses that he's an outsider. He's young. He's running against Washington. He's running against the status quo more than he's running against Trump. He says, you know, even the Democratic Party, he says, needs fresh faces in Washington. The downside is he doesn't have political experience. He lives outside the district, and he's been hard to pin down on some of the issues.
John, one of the great fortunes in talking to you and watching you on CNN is how you break down all these numbers, how you analyze them. And I'm wondering what you make of the fact that already 150,000 people have turned out for early voting. That's almost three times as many as the last time around. Will that tell us anything? Can you read anything into that?
It reads this matters. It reads that initially, and you saw this in the earlier, I'll call it a primary. It's not really a primary, but the first election where you had to get 50% to win, and if you didn't, the two candidates now are in the runoff. So in the first round of this election, people voted. There's a lot of intensity. Democrats think they can win this seat. A lot of money has gone in, not just for TV ads, but for phone calls and emails and social media contacts, door knocking, and belatedly, Republicans saw that. A lot of Republican money has gone in. The two guys I just talked to, they're pros at turnout. They know how to do this. They know how to identify people. That doesn't, they can't, if you're inclined to vote for the other person, they can't change your mind maybe, but they know how to find you and get you a ride if you need a ride or whatever it takes to get you out to vote. The early voting tells me that both parties understand that, you're turning out the last reluctant, skeptical voters on election day. If you run a good election in today's environment, if early voting is allowed, you get most of your vote. You get your locked-in vote out early, and both parties have spent a lot of money and have successful operations to do that. Does one party have an advantage over the other? We'll be counting in a few hours, so I think it's almost senseless to try to get into that.
We're talking with John King from CNN. John, let's move on to healthcare. We talked about it with our listeners earlier, and there's a lot of concern, just about the secrecy, about what the GOP may be doing, about people losing their healthcare. A gentleman emailed to me and said he is on Medicaid, he's disabled, and he's worried he's going to be screwed, was his word. Tell me the political strategy, because it doesn't seem that this healthcare bill is very popular. I read a Kaiser Health poll that had a really unpopular, that's an outlier, it said 8%, but generally around, I think it's the high teens or early 20s, people don't like it. So, and the secrecy kind of adds on to the suspicion. So what's the strategy here?
The reason they're doing it this way, Marjorie, is because they feel they have to. Whether you agree with them or disagree with them, the people doing this, they're not stupid people. They understand if they craft a bill that changes one-sixth of the American economy, that affects every single person listening to this program and every single person in the country, to do it in private and secret is going to get you a lot of flack, right? They're not stupid. They know that. But there are only 52 Senate Republicans. This is an incredibly complicated issue. It is hard to get a Tea Party guy like Mike Lee and Rand Paul and Ted Cruz to agree with more moderates like Susan Collins and of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska or Rob Portman from Ohio. I could go on with this list for you. They have serious ideological, philosophical policy differences about this bill, and they can only lose two votes because if they need 50 plus Mike Pence to get it through. So their calculation is we're going to take a lot of grief for doing this in private. But if we did it in public, every time, here's the Medicaid piece to the gentleman who thinks he's going to get screwed. Here's the essential benefits, and can states opt out? And does opioid, does drug treatment coverage have to be, must it be included in your plan, or could a state opt out and let insurers not put that in your plan? Does Medicaid get expanded or contracted? So they know if they did this in public, every piece of it would be subject to a political barrage, and it would be very hard to get to 50 votes. And so they're taking the risk of the outrage in the short term to try to get to 50 votes and to try to get something they can get through the Senate. That's a giant if. They say they want to have an actual piece of paper that we can all read and digest by Thursday, and then they would vote on it next week before the July 4th recess. If, and I could go on till next Tuesday's appearance, if that happens, remember, even if they pass it through the Senate, it's going to be very
right.
different from the House bill.
Right.
Very different from the House bill. And, can you get the House and the Senate then to agree on something? That's another giant set of ifs that we could go on for a month about. But remember, number one, this is hugely important from a policy perspective. Number two, it has been the mantra of the Republican Party since way before Donald Trump came on the scene. Number three, next year is 2018. It's a midterm election. Midterm elections are defined by base intensity. If the Republicans do not vote to repeal and replace Obamacare, what do they tell their base in the midterm elections?
John, what other do you see other cracks in this? You just mentioned the three individuals that people keep talking about as the Republican senators who would likely not vote or could very likely not vote for this. Susan Collins of Maine, of course, Murkowski of Alaska, as you mentioned, all the way to Rand Paul on the conservative end. Are we going to start to see more defections, or what's your sense?
There are, Jared, I mentioned some of the key players because they're sort of the leaders. There are other senators who follow what Rob Portman does You know, there are senators who respect him, and he's sort of their voice, particularly on the opioid question, because Ohio has had such a problem, much like you've had in New England, New Hampshire, and the like. And so Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, they're talking about Planned Parenthood. Rand Paul, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, they're sort of the missionaries to the Tea Party. And they, you know, they've been clearly on the record. You can disagree with them, but they have been on the record for years saying they want full repeal. The House bill, even the House bill, does not give full repeal. It significantly, dramatically changes Obamacare, but it does not completely repeal Obamacare. The Republicans say it does, but it doesn't, if you look at the policy parts of it. So how do you hold all that together? There are dozens. There are 15, 20, maybe even 30 Republican senators who are very, very nervous about this. Some will follow their leadership. Some are in safe seats, and they will say, okay, this is the best we could do. But I'll say this. Number one, the Senate, again, is only one step in the process. Number two, the results in Georgia tonight could affect this. If you see some dramatic message out of Georgia, whichever way it goes, that could impact. It might make people more inclined to do compromise. It might make them say, no, wait a minute, I'm running from this as fast as I can. One last complication here as we look at the Senate. Imagine you're a senator and maybe you're up next year. Maybe you're not up for 2 years or 4 years. The President of the United States had a Rose Garden celebration for the House bill. He said it was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
He said it was wonderful. He treated it as if it was getting legislation to the finish line. Then last week, in a private meeting with Republican senators, he called that bill mean, repeatedly, mean. Mean's a tough word from your own president if you're a Republican to having a political ad against you. So now you're a senator, and you're going to cast a very tough vote, maybe a vote you don't want to cast, but you're thinking about giving your leadership your vote because they say they need it. Well, how confident are you that the president won't undermine you in 2 weeks? If you see something on television that he doesn't like. So that's a complication here, too.
So, John King, I know not everybody is as obsessed with gerrymandering, but I am kind of obsessed with gerrymandering. And without getting too far in the weeds, basically, districts in Massachusetts, we have districts for Democrats to make it very difficult for Republicans to win in Massachusetts and other states around the country, and Republicans have been better at this. They have districts that it's really almost impossible to win if you're a Republican. The Supreme Court has agreed to take a case to consider whether gerrymandering violates the Constitution. So, we don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do, obviously, but if the Supreme Court did step in and say you can't rig the system to the point where certain Democrats' voices don't count in certain states and certain Republicans' voices don't count in other states, this could be a hopeful chink in the dysfunction that goes on in Congress, I think, and the alienation and the extremes. I mean, this could be a good thing, right?
Right. The last thing I will do is try to figure out what the Supreme Court is going to do. But the fact that they agreed to take this case tells you that we could be on the verge of some significant recalibration in the guidelines, essentially, for the states. The idea here is to the victor go the spoils. So if you have a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, or the flip side, a Democratic governor or Democratic legislature, then they do the census every 10 years. And after that census, if you control power, you control the districts, right? So you're doing your state legislative districts, you're doing your congressional districts. That's an age-old truth in American politics. But because of technology, you can now draw a district where if you and Jared live next door to each other, you're in one district and he's in the other. If the party in power decided, you know, that's how they needed to split up the vote to keep the district. And you've seen the maps of some of these districts.
They're ridiculous.
You know, they're crazy snakes or they're, you know, whatever. I would say this, without having any idea what the Supreme Court will say, this to me is the greatest cancer in American politics. The way we draw House districts. And I'm not smart enough to say, look, winning in politics should mean something. If you win the governorship and you win the legislature, you should have more power than the other party because you won. That's a fact of life. However, we have 435 House seats. In an average year, by the time you get around to Labor Day, there are 25 or 30 competitive races,
maybe 40.
That's just not healthy for the country. It's just not healthy when, you know, your biggest risk if you're a Democrat is getting primaried by a Democrat. Your biggest risk if you're a Republican is a primary. So what does that do? You run to the extreme. You run left if you're a Democrat. You run right if you're a Republican so you don't get beat in a primary. You stop talking to Democrats because there aren't any in your district or Republicans or vice versa. This to me is the biggest issue in American politics. If the House races were more competitive, they would have to respect each other. They would have to reach across the aisle and campaign for other votes. They would have to go home and talk to people from the other political parties. And they couldn't turn on just Fox News or just MSNBC and go to choir practice every day. They would have to respect other people.
They have to watch CNN.
Well, I don't even mean that as a
I'm only
CNN.
Teasing
I,
you, John.
I don't. You know, I said, oh, you're an idiot for putting that. But you wouldn't have to live in your own bubble. You couldn't live in your own bubble because you couldn't be competitive in your own district if you at least didn't talk to and respect, because you would have to get enough of the other votes. I think competition is healthy for everything in life. And if these districts were more competitive, we would get a better product.
John King, something when we first got wind of this a couple of weeks ago, you think this couldn't possibly happen, seems to be unfolding, and that is the broadcast and access to press briefings at the White House now, and apparently even to the president himself when he's speaking to the press. What's happening there? Obviously, we know that these have gotten very contentious, not even talking about the Melissa McCarthy version of press briefings at the White House, but is there a possibility that we're going to lose access to these?
We are losing access already, Jared. Sean Spicer is about to brief today on camera, which has become a rarity in the White House, which is a sad thing. I work in television now, so I want the camera in the room. But I'll also say, they can do this any way they want. And I understand the reasons for not always having briefings on camera. I even understand sometimes why you don't allow audio of a briefing in some circumstances, if you think that is critical. Explain it to us, and we should not over navel gaze here, and we should not feel so special in the media that we demand everything be open and everything be on camera. But transparency in a democracy is pretty damn important. Now, forgive my language, but it is. It's pretty damn important. And so it's not just about the White House briefing. That they won't tell us who the president meets with when he goes off to the Trump resorts on the weekends. They won't even confirm that he's golfing, even though we see him golfing. We have pictures of him golfing, and you say the president golfed, and the White House says, we're not confirming that. That's ridiculous. He's the president of the United States. He ran in a democracy. Do we go overboard sometimes? Maybe. Maybe we do. And I don't have any issue with a politician who says, this one's private, this is my privacy, this is my personal life. For example, there's now an 11-year-old living in the White House, Barron Trump. We should leave that kid alone. It's hard enough to grow up in the White House. We should just let him live his life, and we should not impose on him. And if somebody violates that privacy, the president should tee that person up. But in terms of briefings to ask questions about legislation and meetings and foreign policy, the slide away, and the Obama administration failed its test. It said it would be the most transparent in history, and it did a lot of things to deny access to people, too. So this is not just a Trump thing, but the lack of access and the desire for secrecy has been exacerbated in this administration, and I hope it's something that this is 5 months ago he was inaugurated. I hope as they get their legs, they decide it's a bad idea.
Now, John King, before you go, I have been following this closely, particularly because I've heard Jim Acosta on your station on CNN talking about this a lot, and I just want to know, I'm sure I'm about the millionth person that said he looks like George Clooney's younger brother.
Jim Acosta?
Yes!
I'll let him know he's got a fan in Marjorie.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think there's any blood there, but now you can go online, right? There's so many DNA places. Maybe I'll grab a piece of his hair and
Well, he has been very good talking about this, and he's also been talking about how it's almost impossible for him to get called on in the press conferences, which is not the way it's supposed to go either.
Well, but that's a Trump, and I completely respect Jim fighting for that, so please don't take this the wrong way. But that is a political strategy by Trump, who has told his base that, we're the Clinton News Network or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I get that. And that's the one where I think Jim should fight every day. He covers the building. He should fight every day for his access. But don't take it personally. It's part of a political strategy.
John.
The people watching at home get it.
Hold on. I think it's because Jim Acosta looks like George Clooney's younger brother, and the president doesn't want to see him on TV too much. That's my theory.
Then he should get the Ocean 13 crowd in there. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. So how late are you going to be up tonight, John King?
I hope 10 or 11. I'll be up late, but hopefully you'll be out of work by 10 or 11, but I think I might be here later than that.
I think it's going to be a long night.
Counting votes is fun.
Long night in Georgia. John, thank you very much.
My pleasure. See you guys next week.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, John. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. He joins us every week. He's the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8. Coming up, does your health depend on how healthy your roommate is? A new study says it could. We're asking if this is true for you. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
To Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live because it's Tuesday from the Boston Public Library. Okay, for the next 20 minutes, forget everything you ever saw on The Odd Couple, because in that living situation, it was obvious that Felix Unger's healthier lifestyle did not rub off on the cigar-smoking, beer-guzzling Oscar Madison. But in real life, a healthier roommate could make a difference. A recent study looked at hospital patients and found that putting a patient in a room with someone who was healthier improved the sicker patient's health without affecting the health of the healthier patient. With this dynamic in mind, we are opening up the lines and asking if this is true for you. Think when you have had roommates in your life or the spouse in your life or just back to the college days when you were stuffed in a little room with somebody practically 2 feet away from you every night. Have you lived with someone whose health habits rubbed off on you? Our number is 877-301-8970. Are you the healthy one in the relationship whose habits have rubbed off on the others? Or has your health benefited from living with a health nut? Or maybe you don't agree with the study at all, and you find that when you're around people with bad health habits, folks who may not exercise much or eat too much junk food, those habits spill over to you. 877-301-8970. Has a roommate's health or health habits, good or bad, influenced you? I mean, absolutely, right? Absolutely.
Well, isn't it all about peer judgment at the end of the day? Like, if you're living with people who eat really well or who exercise all the time and whatnot, you're going to kind of do the same thing that they're doing because you don't want to be caught in the middle of the night with your Haagen-Dazs in the middle of the sofa.
Yeah, or, you know, and it's also not just health habits. It's sloppiness. You know, if you are a slob, you know, like in the Odd Couple, you know, if you were the Oscar Madison, Felix Unger's very neat and picking everything up. If you're a slob and you are living with someone who's a slob, I mean, things can really deteriorate very, very quickly. You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's going to be very injurious, right?
Injurious, yes,
injurious,
that's right.
Injurious to the non-clean party. Interestingly enough, I just looked it up just because I was curious. Tony Randall actually died before Jack Klugman, so.
He did?
Not that they were real-life roommates, of course. But
well, that's because all the germs, supposedly. Yeah. Combating all those germs in your life might make you healthy than if you were a germaphobe, like the president doesn't want to. Although he's overcome that because he shakes everybody's hands now, so I guess he's not such a germaphobe anymore. But, I think back to college. You know, my freshman college roommate, we were the two biggest slobs. I remember we had this little refrigerator. We used to keep lemonade in the refrigerator, and it would spill, and we'd wipe it up with a towel. And the towel got so dirty, it would stand up by itself.
Oh, that's disgusting. You were the worst. Oh, I used to hate that because I was an RA for 2 years at Emerson College, and I would hate having to do the room inspections because you would walk in, and you needed a mask for some of the rooms, and it sounds like your room is a room you needed a mask for.
It was pretty gross.
The smell was so
pretty
rank.
Gross. Yeah. I mean, boys, typically you think of as being messier than girls, but we were pretty messy in my freshman year.
Yeah, I think that it's true that women are messier.
So the number is 877-301-8970. The question is, do you feel like your roommates in college or maybe in post-life when you rented an apartment with four or five people, do your roommates' habits, health habits, or otherwise, rub off on you? You know, I think generally this is, I'm making a generalization, but if you have a son who has an apartment with his buddies, or if you yourself are a young man with an apartment with your buddies, you know, you don't normally walk into the kitchen and see things spick and span. What do you see in the kitchen? You see piles of dishes with all the food kind of crusted on the sides, been there for days. You don't normally see that in girls. So I think the pressure to be cleaner is greater on girls, although, as I said, I was a total slob with my roommate. How about you? Have you had roommates in your life?
I had roommates I have had a couple of roommates. It's been a long time.
I know, me too.
In college, I don't really remember. I think we were all pretty neat, but how much can you possibly do in a college dorm room? Well, it sounds like you did a lot.
It was very slobby, and in those days, everybody smoked. So, you know, you didn't want to get a non-smoker if you were a smoker. You know what I mean? You want to be in there puffing away together. You wouldn't want to have your entire dorm room stink if you were not a fellow smoker. So what do you think about this? In the hospital, apparently, if you go in and you have you're both sick because that's why you're in the hospital, but if the person that's next to you in the hospital is taking their vitamins and doing things and making themselves walk down the corridor, even if they don't feel well to get their exercise, does that rub off on you, make you want to drag yourself up out of the sick bed? If you are in college or living as a 20-something or 30-something where you've got a bunch of roommates, do their health habits rub off on you? Our numbers 877-301-8970. Let's start with, I think it's Kupel from Westboro. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, this is him.
Yeah. What do you think about this? Are you a roommate, and have your good or disgusting habits rubbed off on your fellow roommate? What do you think?
No, I'm not a current roommate, but I have a problem with the whole study itself in the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's unfair to talk about how the good habits rub on to the unhealthy patients and they feel healthier without factoring in the control that you have, which is unhealthy patients, or sorry, healthy patients don't get any more unhealthier than what they are. So without having that factored into the study, I kind of feel that it is a little less impactful. So I don't really believe in the point that you presented.
Well, you can look at it. You can look at it yourself. It looks like it's pretty well researched to me. It's from the New York Times. It's in the Upshot. It's written by Austin Frank, F-R-A-K-T, and they have a lot of evidence for this. Yeah. So check it out yourself.
I have it right here. They cite things such as if you have a healthier roommate, then they might be able to impart more information to you, so that you can live a little healthier. That might be one condition. They also say that if you're a little bit healthier, then there's going to be less intrusion in the room, so you do get more rest. You're probably going to recover more quickly. There are a few things that they look to how it does kind of line up.
But thank you for the call. Let's go to Jenna in Danvers. Hi, Jenna.
Hi.
What do you think?
So I room with my boyfriend, and he used to wake up very early, like probably 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. And I wake up very late, and I've kind of trained him to wake up later. he's not super pleased about that. But I think that, like, my negative habit kind of rubbed off on him.
Well, you know,
can I just say, Jenna, come live with me, please, because I can't break myself of that habit of waking up early. I would love to be able to sleep in.
Jenna, I'm getting a lot of people that are emailing that they say that their spouse's or their boyfriend or girlfriend's bad habits. Dan in Boston says his wife has been his roommate for 13 years, and she's turned me into a lazy person. So I guess it does.
I know my boyfriend wouldn't say that, but...
Yeah. Okay, Jenna, how about your neatness? Are you neat or are you a slob?
I think that I'm pretty neat, and we're actually getting a new apartment in September, so hopefully he stays neat.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Jenna. So the issue is not just in the hospital, but in your regular life. Has your roommate's health, habits, sloppiness, cleanliness, have they rubbed off on you and made you more like them if they're...
Or healthier, because I was thinking about, you asked me the question at the outset, have I had roommates? I was thinking I had one female roommate at one point, and I'm such a neat person, and she wasn't as neat as I am, and I think it stressed her out. So I probably didn't help her health in that situation.
Yeah, if you are a slob, there are different kinds of slobs. There are the gross slobs, leave all the dirty dishes in the sink with the food. I'm a clothes slob. I need clothes. There are piles of clothes everywhere. And it is really annoying to people that don't live that way to have to live. I remember it was very embarrassing when I was first married. And I was the wife, obviously, in the couple. And I remember when I was first married.
Is that how that works?
Well, there was a robbery in the apartment underneath us, and so the cops knocked on the door, and they came upstairs, and they knocked on the door and to report that the robbery had happened, to ask if everything was okay in our apartment, and the cop comes in and says, "Looks like this place has been ransacked, too." And I said, "Well, actually, it hasn't been ransacked. This is how it looks 24/7. But it didn't bother my husband because he was a slob. So we were both slobs together. But you can't, if one of you is neat and one of you is a slob, it's going to cause tension in the relationship, I think.
I think that is a factor in partnering up, isn't it? Isn't that one of the first things you kind of pay attention to?
Yeah, I think it's true. And also, if you are engaging in a new relationship, you tend to be, at least at the initial stages, very neat because you don't want to harm anybody when they come over to your place. James Stoughton, what do you think?
Oh, well, I've been living with my wife for 2 years now, and before we moved in together, I was eating chicken patties, bread chicken patties, and pasta Alfredo for dinner every day. But now I have salads for lunch and eat vegetables every night, and I exercise every day. So maybe it's the women who rub off on the men a little more.
Wow.
I'm not sure.
Did you not exercise before?
Oh, I mean, sometimes, but not religiously, not diligently.
So is this because your wife gives you a hard time about this, or is this because you're inspired by her
health?
I'm
inspired. She's so healthy and active. It just makes me want to do it, too, because I feel like a slob if I don't. However, I am much neater, and sometimes I feel like that little robot in WALL-E just wandering around behind her, picking stuff up off the floor.
James, Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the call. So what do you do, Mr. Neatnik over there, if you are in a relationship with someone who's not neat?
I don't think I could ever do that.
Yeah.
I don't. I really don't. Because I would be Wally, as James just said. I would just be constantly.
Now, I have been to your house, Jared. It is, like, very neat.
Well,
I think you might be a little anal about this.
Can I just point out, you were also there for a party.
I was there for a party. Uh-huh. Yeah, I was there for a party. But you didn't have to pick up everybody's cup and wipe off the table every time I took a sip of my drink.
No,
oh, there's Jared. He's chasing me around with a sponge.
I only have three Swiffers just because there's one for, you know, certain times of day and certain rooms.
Oh, yeah.
No,
but the Swiffers are the best, though, aren't they? I mean, do you like the dry mop or the wet mop?
This is horrifying. You know that I just had a birthday. This is the worst thing. Mm-hmm. I just upgraded from the Swiffer to a steam mop because it cleans that much better.
Really?
Yeah.
Should I investigate that?
Yeah, I think you should.
Yeah.
I'll do it for you.
I didn't even have a mop until about 2 weeks ago.
I find cleaning is a stress reliever for me.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I tell you something. You're doing very well, Jared, because the place is really clean.
By the way, if you come to a party, I really don't do everything that Marguerite just said. I promise you can have a fun time at my house.
Yeah. Somebody's dropped a little hors d'oeuvre on the floor, and there's Jared with a dust mop and the brush chasing after them. You know, maybe a little nervous about eating anything. But it's okay, Jared. Everybody's got their little quirks. Everybody's got their little issues. Dan in Jamaica Plain. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I got a couple things. One is my wife is a much healthier eater, pays much more attention to the food that we cook and buy and stuff, and that has had an effect on me so that I'm now a healthier eater because of that. But it only works up to a point, and my daughter's an example, because she's living with somebody who is not as neat as her, and after a while, the roommate just knows that my daughter will just clean up. And so she doesn't have to.
Oh, yes, the taking advantage of the neat roommate thing. That's a great call, Dan. Thank you. I mean, that is true, that you know that sooner or later the other person won't be able to stand it and they'll do something about it. Yeah, and then you take advantage. I mean, issues of housekeeping are very, you know, there's a lot of fighting and arguing that goes on between couples, I think, about who's taking out the garbage and how full the garbage should be, and do we have to take it out right away, can we leave it here, who's cleaning up after themselves in the kitchen. I mean, it becomes a real big point of aggravation.
I know, I remember a friend cautioning me once. She said, Jared, love is not about how you load the dishwasher. I'm still not convinced that that's not completely true, by the way.
But that's a big deal.
Right, I know.
That is a big deal. I get very upset about that when my children load it the wrong way. I want the plates loaded in the certain, you know, order, and if they don't do it that way, I mean, that is ridiculous, isn't it?
The dishwasher is very sacred territory, I think, in just about every home.
You know something? We did a whole segment about this because somebody wrote a piece about this, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago, talking about how the dishwashing loading techniques can make or break a family.
And interestingly enough, I will tell you, that is somewhere where I'm challenged.
Really?
It's haphazard. It's crazy in there.
Really?
Nope. There's no order. Yep.
So you're chasing people with a sponge, but the dishwasher can be haphazard.
Because
okay.
I can't see it.
All right. Our number is 877-301-8970. Do the roommate or your spouse's habits wear off on you, whether it's health habits, neatness habits, whatever? Let's go to Margaret in Dover. What do you think, Margaret?
Well, thank you for taking my call. Well, so I think it's funny, as I'm sitting here waiting, I thought about a little thing my friends gave me years and years, my kids were younger, for my refrigerator. Dull people have clean homes. So
thank you for the call, Margaret. We don't want to hear from you ever again.
That's a good one. Thank you very much. You know, I had this roommate in college, not the one with the chair, the towel so full of lemonade they'd stand up by themselves. This woman had hair down to her feet, literally. We would call her It. And she used to put newspapers all over the floor when her boyfriend came over. I don't know what that was about. Do you know what that was about, Jared?
I do not. I feel like I've just been completely judged here at the end of the show. Good luck finding a host for the rest of the week.
Okay. I'm sorry, Jared. Thank you very much for coming in for Jim today, as always. And I'm sorry I made fun of you with the sponge.
No,
but, you know, just stop doing it and I won't make fun of you anymore.
I'm going to own my cleanliness, Marjorie.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Maybe joining us again tomorrow. National security expert Juliet Kayyem. Our crew is Chelsea Mers, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tresky, Molly Boygon, Christina Bienet. Our engineer is John LaClaw Parker. We're a production of WGBH.
I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jared Bowen.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow. Have a wonderful afternoon and get home and clean up that house. See you later.